everybody. We're live. Sorry for interrupting the song at that point. We finished our pre-flight and decided to go live now, but I had it all timed out. Usually we start about maybe 2 minutes later than the posted time. So I scheduled the song to be like perfectly, you know, ramped up to that time. And instead we got in the air now 4 minutes before the end of the song. So you really didn't hear all of that.
People are really broken up by that, I'm sure.
All around,
you know, it's funny. There are times when I realize, and it's obvious, that we have been friends for years and years, and we've been co-hosts for a decade now. And this is one of those times, because I could not have paid you for a better segue into my very short pre-show that I wanted to share with you. Just a few minutes ago, Declan has shown probably more because he was procrastinating getting in bed than because of genuine enthusiasm, but he was showing an unusual amount of enthusiasm about, you know, the mechanism and machinations of recording. And so, you know, I was explaining, oh, that's the chat room. And he was, you know, talking into the microphone. Wait, nobody can hear me right now, right? No. You know, actually what Marco does is he plays music, and I, you know, logged into atp.fm/live and put on my speakers. And, you know, let it play for a few moments. And I have to concede it. Actually, whatever you were playing didn't sound bad. This is about 5-10 minutes ago. And he listens for a beat. This sounds like Dave Matthews. Yes. Yeah. Now, in the defense of Marco, when I do play, and especially lately, I've been on a bit of a kick. And oh, yeah. When were you not on a kick? Ha ha. No, genuinely, I don't listen to that much Dave Matthews, except lately I kind of have been. So in the defense of Marco, when all he hears is Dave Matthews, I'm sure everything sounds like Dave Matthews, but he said that completely on his own, of his own volition. And I'm not sure I've ever loved my son more than I did that one moment. So I just wanted to share that.
I'll tell you what. So, you know, I'm not even going to touch that because it's adorable. but so, you know, there's new fish out from a recent Mexico series of shows. Mm-hmm. I have had one of the most productive weeks I've had in months. Like, I've just been going through these shows on repeat.
Fish powered month.
I even sent in a bug report to Fish about, because they had like what I think is a mix error where like they like in the middle of a song, they panned Trey's guitar a little bit to the left of center, and then it stayed that way the whole rest of the tour.
So oh, no.
I emailed them like, hey, I think this was a mistake. If you happen to ever adjust that mix, let me know.
Did that go into Dev Null just like Feedback Assistant does?
No, it's been escalated to the audio team, and we'll see if we hear back. But
Hold on.
This is the second mix bug report I've filed with them, and they fixed the first one. The first one was about six months ago.
I'm blue screening over here. You're saying that you filed a report, a bug report of some sort,
to a band,
and a human looked at it and acknowledged it. I'm not even talking about fixing it.
Yep.
You're saying there exists a bug reporting system wherein you get a response, even if the response is screw you, no way. You got a response? Impossible. I can't believe it.
Meanwhile, I have this huge bug that's killing me on iOS 16.4 betas, where it is very frequently. So iOS audio app developers are probably familiar with the audio services were reset notification. And there's a notification you can, you know, subscribe to in the SDK to tell your app when, quote, the audio services have been reset. And you're supposed to, like, you know, if you created any audio objects in your app, you got to like recreate them at that point, reset it all up. You know, if you use audio graphs, reset that up. If you use audio engine, reset that up. Now, what this really, I think, means is a process crashed, like some, you know, system process for dealing with audio, you know, Core Audio D or whatever, some process has crashed. And what this has resulted in is the 16.4 betas. Overcast, almost every time it crosses a podcast boundary, like if you're between episodes, and so it recreates the audio engine, it crashes that background process. I get usually two or three of those services were reset notifications in a row, and playback stops until you go over and hit play again. And I filed a bug report, like, I don't know, almost 2 weeks ago on that? Like, at least one beta ago, and nothing. No response.
Mm-hmm.
No marked as duplicate, no, just sitting mm-hmm. there wide open, Nothing.
Same as it ever was.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And maybe, and my bug report, I had a sysdiagnose. I had the logs from Overcast showing the exact moment that they should be looking in the sysdiagnose for what exactly happened.
Say you've done everything they've asked for, except perhaps a sample app. And I'm sure they must have told you how appreciative they are of all the details that you've provided in this bug report.
Oh, God. You know, I hope at some point in the future, you know, if you look at, like, you know, the boring stuff that, like, you know, whenever you ask people, what do you want of Apple in the future? Everyone's like, oh, I want a VR headset. I want a car. You know, what I want is much more boring stuff, like, make Siri better. That's, like, number one. And number two, hey, maybe fix the developer story in ways that you actually can and might. Like, you know, obviously, they're never going to get rid of a 30% cut. You know, there's going to be some kind of app store cut that's big for a long time, and they're going to require IAP as long as they possibly can, which is probably forever in practice in most places. But, you know, documentation, that'd be great. And, man, it would do wonders for developer relations if Radar/feedback was better. Like, if it was actually a functioning system where, like, we could file bug reports and they would get seen in a timely manner and responded to in a useful way that wasn't just seemingly some bulk process trying to close as many bugs as possible.
Yeah, I that is a fantasy world that I will surely never see. I can't fathom it.
What do you think comes first, self-driving cars or that?
Oh, self-driving cars, full stop. I bet Tesla will ship their full self-driving before Apple gets any better developer story around feedback assistant. Oh, God, I can't even.
That's great.
John, I feel like you had said you wanted to share something with the group as well.
Yes, as the last host of this podcast to catch COVID, I've sort of been playing catch up with you two when it comes to infectious diseases.
Oh, no.
Tonight, I'd like to close the gap a little further by recording my second podcast episode while COVID positive, presumably tying the record held by Marco.
What?
Wait, you had a relapse? You took
I got the rebound, baby.
You took the Paxlovid and got the rebound.
I got the rebound, although there is some debate whether Paxlovid gives you more rebound than nothing, because you can get rebound without taking Paxlovid. But regardless, whatever the cause is, I got it, baby. I've been trapped in my room, and I'm going stir crazy. I got peace. I got 2 days of peace. I got last Wednesday when we recorded, I was negative. And then the Thursday after that, I was negative. And I was out of my house, and I did a bunch of stuff that we'll talk about later in the podcast if we get to it. And then Friday, I went back into my room, and I've been there since, and it sucks.
Now, what?
I mean,
what
prompted you? I mean, I'm not an expert, but I would assume you're probably not contagious at this point. But
You're contagious during rebound.
Really? Oh,
yeah,
man.
You just do the same thing again. Same the rules for it are the same as the first infection. You isolate, blah blah blah. I mean, the good thing is my symptoms haven't been as bad. Like, I didn't really have a fever at all, except for maybe the first day a tiny one. And it's just mostly been a stuffy nose. I'm just sick of being trapped in my room.
Yeah, of course.
So what prompted you to test again? You were feeling crummy.
Oh yeah, I felt on Friday I felt bad. I'm like, you know what, I was feeling better and I had 2 days of negative, but on Friday I felt worse. I felt, you know, not as bad as I did at the beginning, but I felt like, oh, headachy and kind of weird. Like, I'm, you know, I knew the feeling. I was like, this doesn't feel good. So I tested again and positive, and then I've been testing after that to see, oh, well, maybe the rebound will go away quickly. Nope, I was like super duper positive, like more positive than I was in the beginning. Anyway, but I've just mostly been stuck with a snuffy nose. And in fact, today is the first day that my symptoms, I feel like, have gotten better. I have, as judged by the number of tissues in my garbage can, I think I'm definitely on the mend. So tomorrow I'm going to, you know, hopefully I'll see the line fading on my test. But you want to... I want to see what rebound looks like. I'll put it in the Slack so you can see. These are not consecutive days, but they're multi-day gaps between here. But that's what rebound looks like. It's great.
Oh my.
So I'm looking at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 tests.
I love that you line left... these all up, that you kept right? them all. And mm-hmm. you line them all.
I was in my room. What else do I have to do?
So I'm looking at these 9 tests going from left to right. It's very red. And then actually, this even just the second one is, you know, kind of pinkish.
Yeah, there's a big gap between them. So the first one was my first infection, and then obviously I didn't bother testing for a while because, like, you know, you've got it. Like, what's the point? So there's a big gap, you know, between those first two.
Okay, so then it gets, you know, weaker and weaker over time. I would say 1, 2, 3, 4. The fifth one, if there's something there, I can barely see it.
That's my first negative.
Okay, so and then 6 also negative. 7,
that's Friday,
looking pretty positive, and 8 is like, oh baby, yeah, I'm back and better than ever.
It was Friday, and then that Saturday, and I think that's Monday or Tuesday. It just, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, John, that stinks.
Man, I had 2 years between my infections.
Yeah, this is still the same infection. Like, I feel like it, probably the two negatives were just like Paxlovid just wiped it out or whatever, but it was like there was one left in the corner somewhere, and it's like, you know what? I'm coming back.
If it makes you feel better, some very good friends of ours, the husband and wife team of the family, they got COVID. This was maybe a month or so ago, and they did take Paxlovid. And I don't recall if the wife rebounded, but I know that the husband absolutely did. And so he was, you know, he was feeling like garbage, took Paxlovid, complained incessantly about how bad it tasted, which from what I gather from what you've said is completely justified. And then as he's starting to feel better, he starts to come out of his hidey hole, and then, oh, nope, never mind, I'm back. Same story.
I would still take it again, though, because my symptoms weren't getting better. And it was like, my brain cannot be boiling in my skull any longer. So I'm very thankful that it took away. And also there's some, it is possible that taking Paxlovid can help reduce the risk of long COVID as well. I don't think there's anything conclusive on that, but there's some promising studies pointing in that direction. So, but just for the symptom relief alone, I was glad to take it and glad to have it. But yeah, rebound sucks. But hopefully, I mean, by my past schedule, it took me basically a week to go from positive to negative. So I figure rebound is probably going to be similar. So I'll probably be negative by Friday, and then I'll be out of this ridiculous situation.
Ugh, I'm sorry. That is stinky. Well,
and am I right that ties the record? Because Marco definitely recorded at least one episode with COVID, and so did you, Casey. But I don't know if Marco got two of them. Maybe he did.
No, I thought you did, Marco, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, I definitely did.
Did you have three?
No, because I've only had it twice, and well, it depends on, you know, how you define, you know, an episode with it. You know, like the first time I had it, it lasted like, you know, 9 days, so I would have done two episodes, but yeah, it's not fun.
Anyway, here I am recording podcasts, and I had one yesterday as well.
For what it's worth, you sound chipper, and you sound as chipper.
Yeah, no, I'm fine.
Yeah,
it's just
like John.
It's just, I mean, I was more stuffy yesterday. When you hear the next rectives that come out, you hear that I'm even more stuffy today. The stuffiness is drying up.
Oh, well, that's good. Yeah, my snot, I was snotting like up a storm for quite a while. Even after I tested negative, I was still very, very snotty, which was not fun. lots and lots of tissues used in the Liss household, a few weeks ago. But you know what'll cheer you up, John? What'll cheer you up is some follow-up. And we have all kinds of follow-up with regard to the screen time and shoulder surfing stuff. So we were told that screen time passcode doesn't actually protect against iPhone takeovers like we thought it did last week. So we gave you some crummy advice, and I'm sorry about that. Multi Greg writes, I set a screen time restriction with a passcode without the option to remove it using the Apple ID. You know, I tapped cancel and hit skip. When I try the forgot passcode link, it still guides me through the options to enter my Apple ID or device password or find a forgotten Apple ID. Whoopsie dipsie. And also, just FYI, this is us talking, disallowing account changes in screen time also grays out the entire Apple ID item in settings, which is undesirable as well.
It's not necessarily undesirable, but it's confusing. I noticed that. And I'm like, what the hell? Why can't I go into my Apple ID? Why is this grayed out? And when you tap it, nothing happens. So you're like, is my phone broken? Do I need to force quit settings or whatever? Then you remember, oh, I disabled that in screen time. But yeah, like I would blame Apple for this because the UI explicitly says, hey, do you want to allow your screen time passcode to be reset with your Apple ID? And when you hit cancel, it says, are you sure you want to skip this? You won't be able to reset your screen time password with your Apple ID. And you say, yeah, totally skip. And then it's like, no, you can still reset it with your Apple ID. Like, what's the point of that UI? And I tried it multiple times and confirmed. Even though you say cancel and you confirm that, yes, you want to skip it, you don't want to reset it, you can still reset it with your Apple ID. So the mitigation that we said last time, that specific one about the screen time password, if you did that on your phone, just remove it because it's not actually helping. I mean, well, I don't know if you want to remove it because it will slow them down. It will slow down the thief a little bit because now they have to go through the forgot password flow, which is kind of annoying. And, you know, so it's a speed bump, a tiny speed bump, but that's about it.
A little bit of security of obscurity in the sense that, like, they might not realize why the giant bar of your account atop is grayed out because, again, it doesn't tell you.
Interesting point. Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's still not as good as just having a really good passphrase that you never actually enter with people watching.
Yeah, but I just wanted to tell people right up front, like, if you took our advice last week, be aware that does not actually protect you. It is, you know, either a speed bump or security through obscurity at best.
Yeah, it will not slow down a sophisticated attack.
Right.
Sigh. All right. Eric Smets writes, I made an extra. Oh, I'm sorry. This is with regard to protecting your iCloud photos from an Apple ID takeover. Eric writes, I made an extra fake family member with a separate Apple ID, and I added them to the iCloud shared library. This way, I can always use this Apple ID to retrieve all the important shared pictures. The only requirement is that you have room for an extra person in your shared library. And I strongly recommend not saving the password for this new Apple ID in iCloud Keychain. I don't think that this is necessarily something that I am going to do, but it's a very clever approach, and I see no particular problems with it, and it was worth sharing.
The most relevant piece of information here is that, you know, if you have an actual family member, iCloud Shared Library gives more than one person access to presumably your shared pool of photos that you care about. So if someone steals your iPhone, takes over your Apple ID and changes the password and totally locks you out and you never get that Apple ID back, someone else has a copy of those photos in a live Apple ID that still works. I don't know how this works, but in terms of like, well, who is the one who initially shared the photo library? Like, my wife is the iCloud photo library owner, and she created the shared library and shared it with me or whatever. So does it make a difference if her Apple ID is taken over or if mine is? Either way, this is just another form of, probably a weaker form of backup. Like, it's something that I think people are doing. If you have shared an iCloud shared library and you put most of your photos in it, you're kind of getting a secondary backup just by doing that, because someone's got the photos on their phone and their device and stuff like that. It's not as good as a real backup, because a real backup, you would take care to take all the photos and make sure you downloaded them all and save them somewhere that is disconnected from your Apple ID and all that good stuff. So backups are still the solution, but having someone else in the iCloud shared library is a good way to have separate copies of those photos accessible by an Apple ID that may still be live if only one of your Apple IDs gets taken over.
P. Fernandez writes, if my memory is not betraying me, I think in the very first version of iPhone OS, you could set up a password for settings, kind of like a root password. I think Apple should give us that option. I have zero recollection of this, but that does not mean it is not true.
Yeah, I tried to look that up. I had a vague memory of it, but I couldn't really confirm. Do you remember this, Marco? Could you set a passcode on the settings app?
I mean, you might have been able to, but I don't remember this at all.
Yeah, it's difficult to say. Someone should find one of those. Like, we have all these websites that, you know, like System7.app or whatever the hell the thing is, where you can just run old Mac OS in JavaScript in a browser. An original iPhone version of that that runs the original version of iPhone OS with a WebAssembly or something, it would be a cool thing to have, and I'm sure it will turn up in a few years. Then we'll find out.
Right. AF Waller writes, there's a third option besides a short, convenient numeric passcode and a long alphanumeric passcode. That option is a long numeric passcode. This has the advantage of easy numeric keypad, but has an indeterminate number of digits. A 10-digit or 20-digit number is a good compromise for some. For older people, you can tell them to use a childhood phone number or even two phone numbers combined. I didn't even know this was possible. It is somewhat undocumented that if you choose an unlock code but set it to only numbers more than eight or so digits, you get a numeric keypad for entry instead of the normal keyboard. Again, I had no idea.
Yeah, I've never
Someone claimed that they heard about this by listening to ADP. So that is possible, and we all three of us just forgot about it. But anyway,
I think so. I mean, I think people might have heard from us that you can set a, you know, password style passcode, not just numbers. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, cause we've talked about that before. But I did not know that if you go through that process, set a, you know, custom password and only use numbers, then it shows you the number pad for input and just kind of like a text box above it. So instead of having like, you know, the four or six dots so that to see like how many characters you need to fill in, it just has like a text field. So if somebody gets your phone and has not seen you enter the password, they don't know even how long it is, which is one of the benefits of, you know, the passphrase style password to begin with. But if it's just numbers, you get the advantage of easy, you know, large number pad entrance.
That also makes it easier to shoulder surf, obviously.
It does.
I know making it longer is better, but telling which of the numbers you hit on the numpad is way easier than telling which of the tiny keyboard things you hit on the keyboard. But even though they have the pop-up thing that goes above it, it's, you know, anyway, it's all trade-offs. But just, you know, to put this on the table, this is one more option for you to try. If you know you'll never be able to force yourself to use that tiny little, you know, QWERTY keyboard to type things in, but you can use a numeric one, try a phone number or something like that, something longer that that you'll remember.
Indeed. John, tell me about what the latest scam is in the App Store, please.
Yeah, this is related to actually a Twitter thing when Twitter was getting rid of SMS, or I don't know if they ever actually did this. They say all sorts of things, and I can't keep track of which things they actually did that they said or not. But at one point, they were saying, oh, if you wanted to use SMS for for two-factor authentication, you have to pay us money because it's insecure and only the people who pay can use the insecure, whatever. They're a very confused company. Anyway, once they said that, there was a kind of a run on the App Store of like, oh, everyone trying to download authenticator apps like Google Authenticator. Similarly, with this story about Apple ID takeovers, it's like, oh, if I keep everything in my Apple ID and keep it all on iCloud keychain, then it's like once they get my phone passcode, they can get everything. I should use, you know, insert application here, whether it's 1Password or Google Authenticator for my two-factor things, or like just some other app, some other third-party app with its own password, passkey, you know, 1Password has its obvious 1Password, and authenticator apps can have their own passwords and passcodes to get into them and stuff. So that if someone does shoulder surf your phone unlock, then they get to your phone, they still won't be able to get to your passwords or your two-factor unless they know how to get into those third-party apps. So that was sending people to the App Store as well to say, hey, I want an authenticator app. And I need to, you know, I'm going to go see what's available on the App Store because I know I want something that, you know, either stores passwords or stores two-factor codes or whatever. Misc wrote in to say, many iPhone users are asking us to recommend safe authenticator apps. Well, the App Store is making it useless to recommend any app. No matter what app you search for, the top hit is almost always an ad for some scam app. So you can't even say, hey, go to the App Store and check out Authy. Because people will type in Authy and the first hit will be an ad that's very enticing that looks like it's vaguely Authy related that people hit and it's actually a scam. And, you know, you would think Apple would be there knocking down all the scam apps, but the scammers are there ready for their moment. Like, oh, there's a flood of people trying to find authenticator apps. Now's the time. I don't know, even know what the scam is. Do they steal all your passwords? Do they get you to mine Bitcoin? I don't even know what the scam is, but the scam, it's another disappointing example of like, when people are in need, they're like, go to the App Store, the one safe, trusted place for you to find all your apps. And you have a goal in mind, even if you know the name of the app, someone recommended an app to you. This person's saying, we've just given up recommending apps because we know they'll go to the App Store, type in that word, hit search, and then see an ad search result that they don't realize an ad and think, oh, the top hit, that's got to be it, and go get it. And it's not. App Store, bad show.
Yeah, it's like, does anybody besides Apple believe like, oh, this is a great safe place? Like, so I like Apple in general. I think that's been proven, you know, over the years. But man, the App Store is such a sad state of affairs, and it could be so much better. And you know it's a good thing Netflix, you know, can't tell people to go sign up on their website, because that's protecting them against all these scams. I mean, it's just like, you know, even you know, knowing what I know about, you know, the security of the iPhone and everything else, I don't even trust the App Store. The good side of the trust there is that I know that worst case scenario, I can always delete the app. And unlike, you know, some, like on the Mac, this is not the case. On the iPhone, I know that if I download an app from the App Store and then I later delete it, I know that it's gone. You know, that there's no trace of it left. So I am, you know, more willing to try things, and it is more secure than, say, a Mac in that way. But as far as like what happens in the app, I don't trust that at all, because the history of the App Store has been just a slew of horrendously, you know, spying, tracking, misleading, crappy subscription scam apps, and they don't do what they say they will. They don't work. They crash. They show a bunch of ads. They interrupt you constantly. They railroad you into a payment sheet that they hope you'll, you know, double click on or whatever. Like, there's so many like crappy apps that I get from the App Store. Like, anytime I try to do anything that requires me to download a new app, I know I'm going to run into a whole bunch of crap. And
here's an analogy for the old people. Speaking of phone numbers, the analogy is like, you know, you just at the App Store, like, I download an app, I can easily delete it. I'm sure that it's not destroying my phone, or it can't like steal my contacts out from under me because it has to ask permissions. Like, that's the type of assurances you have. It's like saying with the phone system, I can be assured that the phone lines are secure. People aren't tapping into them because you have to get a warrant. And if someone does tap into it, it's a federal crime. And or the U.S. mail, or any of these type of sort of older transport mechanisms where we have laws and strictures around them that make them fairly secure and safe with very onerous penalties for people who, you know, go against that. Right. Not the newer ones, but the older ones when we could still pass laws like that. It's like, so that means there'll never be any fraud over the telephone line or the mail system, will there? Well, the telephone line is secure, but telemarketers still call up old people and get them to reverse mortgage their house and stuff, right? Like, so the App Store, yes, the installation process is secure and it's not going to screw up. Like, the line is secure, right? That is as safeguarded as it can be. One company controls it. It's like back in the old AT&T days. One company controls it. You have to buy a phone from them. Huh, you actually do have to buy a phone from Apple, isn't it? See that? and everything's secure on that line. But then someone calls you up and talks you into, you know, doing a reverse mortgage on your house, or gives you your credit card number or whatever. And that's exactly what's happening. Once the app gets on your system and it says, hey, you should sign up for our thing and type your credit card number here, or do it like, oh, and how did that get through AppReview? I don't know. How the hell does anything get through AppReview? Like, the securing of the line and the mechanism to deploy the apps is nothing without the securing of the actual apps that arrive. And Apple is just not up to that task. And even if it's a benign scam where it's like wasting your time and trying to get you to, you know, sign up for a $1 a month subscription or something that you don't know you need, or like, there's all sorts of ways that these applications can be user hostile while still being within the letter of the law, and somehow they get through Apple App Review, but Untitled Goose Game gets rejected twice by the Mac App Store, and then they give up.
It's so bad. And I mean, they're so petulantly refusing to listen to reason that it sounds like they're going to be forced to. And honestly, they deserve it. We've talked about this many times. We don't need to belabor it again. Not yet, anyway. Bob Van Show? Skio? I'm not sure there.
Before you go there, do you know the title, the heading there? This gives you ample opportunity to get a reference, Casey.
This is War Games.
Thank you. Very good. Mm-hmm. So this is making up for your missing the net last episode.
Yeah. Oh, God. I'm so mad at myself for that. I genuinely am. Now, in my defense, I haven't seen that movie.
I heard Marco get it, and I know he got it. We've talked about it before on the show.
I messed up. I
you probably weren't paying attention. It's fine.
Maybe. I don't know. I issue myself several demerits. I'm so sorry. I have shamed all of us. But anyway, the heading in the show notes is Strange Game. The only winning move is not to play, which is War Games. So anyway, Bob Von S writes, this is going to sound bananas, but here it goes. I have no password, Touch ID, Face ID in my phone. When Touch ID came out, I could not get it to work consistently, so I turned it off and never bothered with Face ID. I live on a farm, homestead thing, and so there are many instances where I'm wearing gloves, some kind of hat, face covering, my hands are wet, dirty, scratched up, etc. Touch ID never worked beyond 2 or 3 days. I also don't have a passcode because that's just cumbersome with these hand conditions. That said, there really isn't a lot on my phone that would cause me material harm if someone got my phone. I use a small regional bank whose app is basically a web view to their site, so you have to log in with a username and password. Otherwise, you can see pictures of my dog, what I listen to in Overcast, and about 10,000 spam emails. Good for you. But the point is, when I go into iCloud in settings and tap password and security, I'm only prompted for my iCloud password. So if all you've done is stolen my phone, you can't lock me out of my Apple ID without my iCloud password. And since there isn't anything particularly interesting or useful on the phone itself, you only have a short amount of time to capitalize on the device by selling it or whatever, because I'm pretty sure I can wipe the phone from my Mac. So unless I've missed something obvious, my lack of security has come full circle, where I have ultimate convenience and minimal exposure to badness. This horrifies me, but I mean, the logic does add up, at least on the surface.
There are some vulnerabilities here, but the perverse thing is, by not having a passcode, you can't use your passcode to unlock your Apple ID. Yeah. Right? You just can't, because there isn't one. So there's no mechanism for it to say, hey, I want to, you know, I forgot my password to my Apple ID, right? The bad side is, I think, even if you don't have a passcode, the I forgot the password to my Apple ID may find its way through your trusted device of the iPhone, because there are other ways that Apple can prompt you on your supposedly trusted device of an iPhone to say, hey, I see you're trying to reset your password. Is this you? I know Apple doesn't do the text message thing, but they have those pop-ups or whatever. So I'm not 100% willing to endorse this.
Well, they do have text message fallbacks.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose, because, yeah, you could be, if you have a telephone number or whatever. So I don't think this is maybe as secure as he thinks. But the other thing that he's doing is, if you don't have anything of value on your phone, when someone gets your phone, then they don't have anything of value. Like, that works. That, you know, the only winning move is not to play. Hey, don't have anything valuable on your phone, so when someone steals your phone, you don't care. Probably not the best solution, but I did think it was funny that by literally not having a passcode at all, and no biometrics, which I think is silly, but not having a passcode at all, as if you're living in, like, you know, 2008 with your iPod Touch like me, where you just slide to unlock. Yeah, that's one interesting way of looking at it. I just hope there aren't any, a lot of iPhone thieves stalking you out there on the farm. I think you're probably safe. Yeah.
I would just like to quickly note that the only winning move is not to play. Also, War Games. I just want to make sure the appropriate credit. All right, moving on. The headline for this is Those Darned Kids, which I'm assuming is a Scooby-Doo reference. Gosselgold writes, my son got the screen time pin when he handed me his phone over so that I could give him more time. I made sure that he could not watch me enter the pin. Except he had started a screen capture before giving the phone to me. This is
totally
so good.
Owned.
So good.
This is amazing.
Oh, that makes me so happy.
There are so many people gave it the same story that their kids. I guess this is going around in like the, you know, the kids circles of like, just start a screen recording and ask for more time and give your parent the device and then you'll see what they typed in. Because it's because the screen recording will show what things highlighted, you know, when you hit the numbers or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's very, very good.
That's incredible.
There's so many more exploits people have sent us, though. Like the iMessage apps, even if iMessage itself is secure, like the exploit that my kids were using, the iMessage apps have ways to get through it. Someone was saying that if you ask for a one more minute time in three separate apps, there's a bug that just totally stops all screen time prescriptions. Like, not if you don't even have to get it. Just go to app number one and say one more minute. Go to app number two, say one more minute. Go to app number three, say one more minute. You don't need a parent to approve those things at all. Just by merely requesting it in three different apps, then downtime for the phone just goes away.
That's amazing.
Apple. With regard to ISP bandwidth, and I think it was an Ask ATP asking, you know, what do you do with your gigabit connections anyway? Michael Hansen writes, one thing that you didn't mention in the discussion about asymmetric bandwidth, TCP needs the uplink speed for ACMS or acknowledge packages. If you saturate your uplink, download speeds will suffer heavily too. So in other words, you know, the way TCP works, which is the way most of the internet is hung together, when you download something, you need to acknowledge, okay, I've got this. And so what Michael is saying is, if you're downloading something crazy fast, well, you need to send those, yep, I've got it messages back to where it's coming from. And it can end up that you have more download bandwidth to spare, but you're flooding your upstream bandwidth with, yep, got it messages. And that would be very unfortunate.
Yeah, this is why, like, you know, nowadays, most routers that people have in their houses and everything are a little bit better at dealing with this. But this used to be a problem back in the day because, you know, if there was no QoS kind of prioritization on routers, which there wasn't for most home routers until, you know, fairly recently, you could have somebody where, like, if you, like, you know, took a video on your iPhone and then you plugged your iPhone into charge, it would upload it to iCloud and it's uploading, you know, this 2 gig video you just shot on your phone, and then the Wi-Fi is, quote, down for the entire rest of the house because everyone else is trying to do stuff and your phone is saturating the upstream and so nothing else works. So it's one of the many reasons why having a whole bunch of headroom on your upstream bandwidth as well is very important, because you can't do that. And of course, you know, if you have a modern router that supports prioritization and QoS kind of stuff, then this problem is largely mitigated, but it definitely helps.
Moving on, John, tell me about a problem with the Apple TV remote with touch disabled, please.
Yeah, last episode we were talking about the ability to force quit apps without the ability to swipe them up. And of course, the answer there is to double tap the up button, something that many, many people sent us on Mastodon while they were listening to the show, only to learn minutes later that we said that. So we caught a lot of people in that one. We don't do this on purpose, by the way, but it is fun to see how many people do respond in real time as they're listening, right? And the answer is a lot. One more thing from Eric Hemeter. It says, when you disable touch on the Apple TV remote, you don't have a way to find out what the screensaver location is. So the screensaver shows like different places on Earth, like with a slow camera pan over them or whatever. And if you just touch the touchpad, not click it, but just touch it, it says, oh, this is London or this is whatever. Like, it tells you the location, because you're always curious, like, what city is that? Where is that? So now we'll do it again. We don't know how to get that to appear without touch enabled, but maybe before the end of the show, we'll find out and say it in the show. So if you know, you should probably finish listening to the whole show before you send a message to Mastodon telling us how to do it. Now, chat room, the race is on. You have to figure this out before the end of the show, so the people who send us a message will feel embarrassed by the fact that they didn't wait to hear the answer.
Oh, my word. All right. Go ahead.
I was going to say, otherwise, we'll find out next week.
Indeed. All right, we have some yellow things follow up. Joel McIntosh writes, the best and worst car colors for resale value, according to carpro.com, which I've never heard of, but that's neither here nor there. According to carpro.com, they write, while it may be among the least popular color choices, because it's gross, yellow is the vehicle color that holds its value best overall, depreciating 70% less than the average vehicle. And
just for reference here, I saw this too, and I was going to do a victory lap, but then I thought, but at the same time, though, most cars aren't available in yellow. So the ones that are available in yellow are already, like, you know, more rare, more specialty models most likely. And so I think that might be skewing the data. Like, you know, you can't get like a Honda Accord in yellow.
Is it not normalized for within each car? Like, is it just, I don't know. But to look at the stats. I figured they would do it within each car. So this car comes in five colors, one of which is yellow, and the yellow one depreciates 70% less. Like, that would be the stat, not what you're saying, like, across all cars.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I believe it because you know why? Yellow is a fun color. When people buy a used car, they want it to be fun.
Anyway, I also would like to point out that it says in the same article, and I am pointing this out because I'm trying to be better. The colors that retain the best value by segment are, and for the SUV segment, the answer was yellow. Similarly, even though this isn't a car thing, well, I fucked around and found out it because Apple has released a yellow iPhone. So this could not have been a better troll. To be honest, and genuinely, I'm not trying to be funny. I think this is not my favorite yellow, but I'm in full support of fun iPhone colors. Just because I don't like yellow cars doesn't mean I don't like yellow other things. I have my Playdate sitting on the desk in front of me. I adore the yellow, although it's honestly like an orangey yellow, but I adore the Playdate yellow. This is a little aggressive, but I'm still here for it. I'm in favor of it. I wish we could get the pros and fun colors, as we've all lamented many times, and particularly the colors ours on upgrade. No, this is cool. I dig it.
Yeah, this is. It looks fun. It is fairly light, and in fact, Apple also released a whole bunch of yellow accessories in their spring color refresh. They got some new watch bands, new iPhone cases. Nothing that jumps out at me necessarily, but I want to go see him in person. There's what might be a promising orange on the sport band. But yeah, going back to the yellow phone, it looks fun. You know, whenever they do this in the spring, you know, they do some kind of, you know, minor iPhone color refresh in the spring in the last few years. It's a fun thing. I don't know a lot of people who get them because most people in our circles will make their buying decisions in the fall. This is more for like, you know, the back catalog of when they go on and sell this phone for the next few years, or it's for people who haven't upgraded yet and you know, don't just jump on it in the fall and, you know, they just kind of get it whenever their previous phone dies or breaks. And, you know, so it's capturing some of that market. But it looks like a pretty good color. And like Casey and like Upgrade, I do wish they would give us these fun color options on the Pro phones. So maybe in our titanium USB-C future, maybe they'll be a little bit more generous with the colors. Who knows?
Rumor is it's like some, you know, darkish magenta type thing is the new Pro color, but we'll see.
Yeah, it's like a maroon. Actually, the I don't know if they're renders or what, but like the mock-ups using that color actually looked pretty cool to me, but we'll see.
It's harder to guess colors. You know, when I saw this yellow phone, I thought it looked like the E36, the yellow E36 BMW 3 Series. Mm-hmm. I was trying to figure out what that color was, so I put a picture of it, a link in the chat room. Well, I guess we'll put it in the show notes. It was Dakar Yellow 2, Roman numeral 2. It's a little bit more, because there's a Dakar Yellow that looks really like deep, saturated yellow, but I always remember the one from walking down Com Ave in the 90s at BU, seeing all the BMWs that belong to the wealthy students. And I saw this yellow all the time, and it was definitely kind of a pale yellow. And that's what I feel like the phone is. The phone is not, like, even though people have been holding it up next to the Playdate is richer and more orange. This is more kind of like, it's not totally pale yellow. It's not like, you know, springtime pastel yellow, but it's a little bit more pale. It's not Big Bird yellow, right? Is it R1S yellow? I don't know, because I can't figure out what yellow that freaking car is. Every time I see a picture of it, it looks a different color.
Yeah, me too. I have yet to, I feel like I don't have a good handle on what the color is. Like, it's, in pictures I've seen, it has looked everything from basically like champagne gold to like super, like, you know, you don't drink enough water.
Big Bird yellow. Sometimes it looks Big Bird yellow. How is this the same color?
Yeah.
I don't know if this is my reformed BMW fan speaking or something, but this Dakar yellow, as yellows go, and I stand by that yellow cars are gross. As yellows go, this is pretty good.
Hey, yeah, if I ever buy my old classic Toyota MR2 that I've always wanted, that comes in yellow.
You gotta get that in fake Ferrari red, because it's a fake Ferrari Toyota.
Red is kind of like the default like MR2 color, if I'm honest.
It is.
But that is a cool yellow.
This and when yellow, they catch fire, they turn orange.
This yellow, Marco, is not good. It is not good. I do not approve.
I would drive it straight to your house.
That's fine. I would love for you to do that because it has been too long since we've seen each other and you visited and vice versa. But I do not approve of this yellow.
Yeah, if I'm honest, you know, the correct color for the MR2 Turbo is red. But, you know, oh well, someday.
One day. All right. Let's talk about some other stuff. Is there a spring event? Boys, what's the story here?
We just talked about the yellow phone, and the yellow phone was one of the things rumored for the spring event. But of course, they released the yellow phone and gave it to, they had like, you know, press briefings remotely or whatever and handed out the yellow phones to people and stuff. They did all the thing, right? Like, and they did it without an event. So is there going to be an event or was there going to be an event? They said, nah, no event, we'll just send people yellow phones. We don't know. But either way, the rumors about the things that might have been in that event are some vaguely interesting developments in the Macs that I care about, at least. So the first one is the one we talked about a couple of past episodes, is the Mac Studio. We talked about the rumor like, oh, the Mac Studio is not going to be updated that often. Oh, is it a dead machine or is it just going to skip a generation or whatever? The rumors are stronger now with that have the Mac Studio skipping the M2 Ultra. Right now, the Mac Studio, you can get an M1 Ultra in it. And it would make sense if you think like, oh, we're just going to update all the Macs every year with the next big M number. The Mac Studio have the M1 Ultra, and then we'll get the M2 Ultra because we've got the M1 Pro and Max and a bunch of other Macs, right? And it's time for the M1 Ultra to be in the new version of the Mac Studio. Seems like that's not going to happen. That is related to everyone's favorite Mac, the Mac Pro, where the rumor that we talked about in past shows about that is the 4X one, the one that would have been two M2 Ultras shoved together somehow magically, that chip was canceled, that Apple's not making it. And part of the reason why that chip may have been canceled is, you know, what we talked about before, low volumes, not a lot of people are going to buy that. It's going to be super expensive and high cost. And this is something I think we didn't get into as much in that past episode when we talked about it, but when Apple put Xeons in its Mac Pros, like the one I have here, Intel Xeons, those are expensive chips, right? And Apple didn't get to make them. Intel made them. And Apple had to pay Intel's markup on them and so on and so forth. And they were still expensive chips. But Apple benefited greatly from the fact that Mac Pros are not the only place Xeons appear. Xeons are mostly sold into the server market. And what Intel hopes is tons and tons of them sold, way more than Apple's ever going to sell Mac Pros. They're selling servers from Dell. I don't know if HP still sell things, and just into data centers everywhere. Xeons being a server chip, a big expensive server chip. That's what Intel's selling. Oh, and by the way, Apple, since we're your chip supplier and you need some big honking CPU for your top end computer, you should probably buy a Xeon from us. Here's the ones we have to offer. And that was frustrating for Apple. So they're like, we don't really want the Xeons. If we can make a chip for a Mac Pro, it would be different. It would be better, right? Well, now Apple has its wish. They can make their own chip for the Mac Pro. But lo and behold, when it's time for them to make a chip for the Mac Pro, they're like, geez, it costs a lot of money to make this chip that's two M2 Ultra stuck together. You know, and because it's not like Apple's making it themselves, they have to farm it out. They have to, you know, have it done in the fabs for, you know, TSMC fabs at 3 nanometers or whatever. Then they have to package everything together with whatever weird interconnect. You know, we only know what the M1 Ultra has as an interconnect, and Brazil M2 Ultra will have one. We don't know what the plan was for 4 because geometrically, like the M1 Ultra is just connected to end to end. If you've got 4 of them, how do you connect them? And there was all those rumors that we talked about before about how that would work. But anyway, that is a weird thing to do. And then you have the packaging where you have to put all that thing in a package with all the RAM chips around it and put it all together. And that's expensive, really, really expensive, because again, Apple has to pay manufacturers to do all that. They have to pay someone to, you know, print the silicon chips. They have to pay someone to do whatever interposer stuff that they do. They have to pay someone to package it together, and they have to pay someone for all the RAM chips. And it's like, and the people who they're paying to do that, they're like, okay, so how many of these do you want? And Apple's like, I don't know, a dozen. Who's going to buy? How many people are going to buy this Mac Pro? Like the volume, not that they're that low, but like the volumes are low compared to Intel Xeon, right? And so now it's like, it's a reckoning. It's like, well, if you want to make your own chip for the Mac Pro, you think you can do a better job than a Xeon? You're only going to sell a tenth, a hundredth as many Xeons. And so everybody you pay to do this is going to charge you an arm and a leg because you're not ordering, you know, 10 million from them, that you're ordering in small volumes. You are a small volume manufacturer of like bespoke artisanal Mac Pro chips now, even though you're trying to reuse all the building components from like the Mac Studio and the laptops and stuff. Like, they're already trying to save money that way. But the one way you can't save money is, well, if you want if you want four of those things in here, you have to connect them some way and you have to package them, and that costs a lot of money. And it seems like Apple ran away screaming from the idea of actually paying for that chip because their volumes are just not high enough. And I guess even Apple thought, we can't, you know, if you're going to charge us that much, then we have to charge our customers so much money. Then they're going to be like, no one's going to buy this Mac Pro, because instead of it being a $10,000 machine, now it's an $80,000 machine. And it's, you know, not eight times faster for that advantage. Now, I don't know any of that for a fact. That's just speculation. But it's something that occurred to me when I thought about why they bailed on the 4X chip. And it's relevant to the Mac Studio skipping the M2 Ultra, because if the Mac Studio skips the M2 Ultra, then you can roll out the Mac Pro with an M2 Ultra and say, it's the fastest Mac, because the Mac Studio still has the M1 Ultra. So if you had updated the Mac Studio, it'd be like, why would I ever buy a Mac Pro? It's got the same system on the chip as the Mac Studio. They both have the M2 Ultra. I don't need any slots. I don't understand. And I can't put GPUs in the slots anyway, or whatever the hell the story is going to be there. Why would I ever buy a Mac Pro? But now, by logically, as we discussed previously, not updating the Mac Studio every year because it is also a low volume device, the Mac Studio stays stuck with the M1 Ultra, the Mac Pro gets the M2 Ultra, and Apple gets to put a bunch of graphs on stage showing how much faster the Mac Pro is than any of their other Macs. And I think that makes a perverse kind of Apple sense in terms of how they explain the machine, how they run away screaming from the cost of making the big 4X thing, and how the Mac Studio update cycle can skip a chip generation. Just like, I mean, I'm presuming eventually the ARM Mac Pro will also skip chip generations, just because the lower the volume, the less Apple seems to be able to justify updating the machine every single year.
Yeah, I think, you know, the rumors and you know, quote information that we keep hearing about the Mac Pro are so all over the place that the more I think about it, the more time goes on, the more I think either you are right that you know, the Mac Pro will basically just be the studio with slots of some kind and you know, same chips and everything otherwise, or the rumors are way off, just totally wrong, or option three, the Mac Pro will actually never ship. And I don't know which of those is the most likely at this point.
An Apple person recently in an interview gave vague reassurances that the Mac Pro is still coming, like, as in, I think, like, less than a month ago.
I mean, they said AirPower was coming, and then it didn't.
I know, but, right? They said the Mac Pro was coming in that event presentation, whatever it was, last year sometime, right? And it's like, okay, well, maybe the plans have changed since then. But I feel like if many, many months have passed since then, and an Apple person officially is saying to the press, oh, yeah, the Mac Pro is coming, I feel like that means it's coming.
I hope
what's
so,
coming. And I agree with you that we could be totally wrong, because this is the type of stuff that doesn't leak because no one cares about it except for us.
And the thing is, like, again, like, the rumors are so all over the place. Whatever the Mac Pro is currently rumored to be is usually something that is so far different from everything else in the Apple Silicon lineup that it is kind of, it seems like kind of a reach that's what they would be doing. And so it's just, I don't know. I'm starting to get worried, really, about the Mac Pro. Like, I'm starting to think, you know, either
then
the rumors are
then you're
way
doing
wrong.
It right. This is the Mac Pro experience.
This is our show for the last decade. It's like
you're starting to get worried about the Mac Pro. You say, Marco, yeah. We can play this clip at any time in the next 20 years, gosh. And it will be true,
or the past 10. No. Yeah. So I hope the answer is that the rumors are just wrong, or at least largely, because they're so all over the map. And kind of not encouraging I'm hoping that's the real answer, because that does happen too. You know, yes, Apple does fail at things and change their minds. Also, rumors are wrong a lot. You know, so I think I wouldn't say which one is more likely to be the case, but the rumors just don't make sense with what else we know and what else we expect. And so, you know, either they're going to kind of, you know, chicken out of the high end, like your theory about the, you know, the Mac Studio being skipped a little bit and stuff like that, or something's wrong.
We shall see.
There's some other Macs that were rumored potentially for a March event that may or may not happen. The iMac, the 24-inch iMac, that hasn't been updated in a while. It still has the plain old M1, no modifier, no suffix, and it's fine for that, you know, size of computer. But the idea is, okay, well, that will eventually get the M2, won't it? Seems like maybe not, because the M2 has been out for a while, and the machines that Apple would update with the M2 have mostly been updated to the M2, but still not the iMac. So most recently, Gurman thinks that there won't be an update to the 24-inch iMac until the second half of the year at the earliest. And by that point, the M3 will be available. So it could be that the iMac also skips a generation and goes from M1 to M3, presumably for similar reasons. Not a lot of people buy desktops, right? I guess the iMac is probably, well, I don't know, which sells more, the 24-inch iMac or the Mac Mini? Probably the iMac.
Probably
right?
The iMac.
Oh yeah,
those are sold in a lot of like offices and stores. Yeah, and, yeah. They but anyway, sell a number of those.
The volumes compared to the laptops have to be smaller. Is that why it's skipping a generation? You know, we don't know. It, like, because of supply chain COVID and because of the ARM transition, it's still very difficult to pick up patterns in Apple's, because it's still much chaos. Like, what is their pattern? What is their update cadence related to that? Again, I think it was Gurman, not an Apple spokesperson. Gurman said something to the effect that Apple, again, declaring this with no sourcing or anything, but just saying Apple seems to want to update their Mac SoCs on a yearly cycle, just like the iPhone. So, you know, A15, A16, A17, they want to do M1, M2, M3 every year, not a 1.5 year cycle, not a 2 year cycle. Every year they want the M number to go up one, just like the A number goes up one. If that's true, I endorse that plan. Apple is, you know, go for it. But that doesn't mean they're going to put those updated numbers in every one of their Macs on a yearly cycle, as evidenced so far by the Macs that have not come along to the M2 generation. And the rumor is that some of them may wait for the M3. So we'll see. By the end of 2023, presumably 24-inch iMac will be updated. Will it be updated with an M2? Or will it be updated with an M3? Related to that, one more Mac, the 15-inch MacBook Air that everyone's been talking about. The MacBook Air already has an M2 in it. They already updated that one from M1 to M2. So that's out. That's here. The 15-inch one, the sort of, straightforward rumor is it'll be just like the existing 13-inch MacBook Air, except it'll be 15 inches. It'll have a bigger battery, and it'll have a bigger screen, and it'll have an M2 in it. And that's a perfectly fine product. I think it's great. I think it fills a hole in their line. I think it's cool. There are some rumors that it might have an M2 Pro in it instead of an M2, because you've got more room and more cooling. The thing that I've been thinking about that I haven't seen anyone say yet, and it's been weeks, and I figure someone would have done it by now, but if not, I'm going to say it. They talk about the rumor like maybe it won't even be called a MacBook Air. Huh, I wonder what it will be called. And they never let the other shoe drop. Wonder what it will be called. What will it be called? Two co-hosts of ATP. If it's not called MacBook Air and it's 15-inch, what will it be called according to Apple's current naming conventions?
Maybe MacBook just by itself, but
yeah, that's what I was going to say.
But it's a little big for them.
Am I the only one who thinks this? MacBook Studio. That's what's between the bottom end and the Pro. It's the Studio suffix. It's the MacBook Studio. It's 15 inches. It's got an M2 Pro. The MacBook Studio. It's right there.
I don't buy it.
Studio is higher up the line. Studio basically means desktop Pro right now. Like,
no, it's below. It's below Pro. Right? Because the Mac Pro is above the Mac Studio. The MacBook Pros are above the MacBook Studio.
I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. I don't think it makes too much sense for 15-inch MacBook Air.
Yes, it probably just should be. This was predicated on it coming with the M2 Pro, which is one of the rumors, right? If it just comes with the M2, it's a 15-inch MacBook Air. That's literally what it is, right? And that is the most straightforward thing.
That. Like, I don't think they would give it the Pro chip.
Yeah, I mean,
or best you could option the Pro chip, and it would not come by default.
Oh, it definitely come by default.
Yeah, no, I feel like this really depends on whether Apple does what they did with the 14 Plus, which is like, we want to have a larger version of the cheap phone, right?
Yes.
And that's basically like it's 14 inside there. It's just bigger. Like, that is straightforward what it is. Or they could say, no, we still refuse to do that. If you want anything with a 15-inch screen, you're going to pay more, because that's a step up. And even though we could make a 15-inch MacBook Air, we're not going to. We're going to make a, like, you know, scaled down 16-inch MacBook Pro, and we'll call it the MacBook Studio. I hope they make the 15-inch MacBook Air. They call it the Air. It has the Air motherboard. It has Air-like pricing. It'll be more expensive than 13-inch, but not that much more, because I think that's the product they need to make. But if they can't resist saying, well, no, as soon as that screen gets bigger than 13 inches, we're going to need more money from you. If they do that, then it's a MacBook Studio. Although I do admit that naming convention is too consistent for Apple to do it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I expect this 15-inch MacBook Air. This seems to be a real deal. The rumors are very strong, and I hope it's real, because I think they'll sell a ton of them. I think it's a great idea for a product. And I don't think that it will too badly cannibalize the 16-inch, just because I don't think, you know, if you look at the current price gap here, you know, the MacBook Air, even if you get the new M2 model, it's like $1,200, and the cheapest 16-inch is $2,500. This is a huge gap, and so I would expect a MacBook Air 15-inch going from $1,200 from a 13-inch. I would guess maybe it's $200 or $300 more. So maybe it's like $1,500. That's still very far from $2,500. So that, you know, that's the kind of difference I would expect there. And if they do that, and it's otherwise the same computer with no other changes, no Pro chip, nothing higher spec, just a bigger screened MacBook Air for a few hundred dollars
and a
more.
Bigger battery, importantly, which I think is going to make that machine extremely attractive.
Yeah, but you know, honestly, I don't even know how much. I mean, the battery would need to be proportionally bigger just to have the more screen area be lit up.
But it doesn't need
more battery life. The MacBook Air has tons of battery life.
I know, but what I'm saying is, I think the battery, the amount of extra area they have for battery, is more than enough to account for the larger screen size. I don't know if I'm right about that calculation, but that's my gut feeling that they will have excess battery. And since the M2 MacBook Air already has good battery life, this thing will be a battery camel, and I think it will make it very popular. Because hey, you pay a little bit more money, you get a bigger screen, and even more battery life. That is a very attractive machine. Like, I've wanted Apple to make a machine like this for a long time. That's why I kind of feel like I can't believe they're actually going to do it. They did do it with the iPhone, and the rumor is the 14 Plus or whatever is not selling that well, which disappoints me, and I hope they don't get scared by that and pull a mini and be like, oh, we did that once and people didn't buy enough of them, so we're not doing it again. It's like, Apple, every model can't be the best seller, and they're not all going to sell evenly. Someone's one phone is always going to be the one that sells the least. It doesn't mean you cancel that one. Just have a cheap phone and big and small, an expensive phone and big and small. And Apple seems to be like, well, we made a cheap phone and big and small, and not enough people bought the big one, so we're back to just small. If you want more, pay more. I don't like that attitude. And instead, what they're going to do is the iPhone Ultra, right? It's like, well, we had the iPhone Pro, and that wasn't expensive enough, so we're going super high end. It's the iPhone that is. We haven't talked about the rumor, but the iPhone Ultra rumor is out there that there's, you know, an even higher price point for the one that's made out of diamond or whatever.
No, but going back for a second, so the 15-inch Air. So first of all, your battery camel theory is good. I'm not sure they would necessarily do it, though, because batteries are heavy, and the Air brand means thin and light. I mean, it means mainstream.
I'm saying they're not making it any thicker than the 12. They just get more battery because it's 15 inches. Like, that's just,
yes,
it's free real estate.
But the it's not free weight, though. That's why.
They're not going to leave it empty with Air, haha.
No.
Like, it's going to be filled with battery.
They can put a cellular modem in there.
Actually, they can't. That's impossible. It's been proven.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
But yeah, also, you know, so anyway, this machine I expect to be great. It feels a little early to be seeing any M3 Max. You know, the M2 MacBook Air just came out last summer. So right.
Yeah. No, the MacBook Air is not rumored to be the 15 inch is not rumored to be M3. The only ones that have rumored to be M3 is potentially the iMac, which would be second half of the year, and that's there was a couple other M3 ones rumored about more of this, but even the Mac Pro, that would be M2 Ultra, not M3 Ultra.
Yeah, so we'll see about all that. But anyway, the 15 inch Air, it sounds real. I think they're going to do a good job with it, and I think, you know, it continues. It fills in a huge gap in the lineup, because right now, if you want a bigger screen than 13 inch, you have to, again, like, more than double the price. And cannibalizing the 16 inch, I don't think is a huge problem, because what you get with the 16 inch is not just one more inch of screen space. You're getting way higher end components in other areas. Like, when you compare to what the MacBook Air offers today versus what the MacBook Pro offers today, the MacBook Pro has way better screen, way better performance, way higher resource limits, better speakers, better microphones. Like, it's a lot better in a bunch of ways. And so a 15 inch Air would not really eat into that. Meanwhile, if you are looking at the MacBook Air at $1,200 and you're like, well, I wish the screen was a little bit bigger, you don't go look and say, oh, well, okay, I'll pay $2,500 for the extra couple inches. No, you just buy the smaller MacBook Air, or you go buy a cheap PC. So I don't think that upsell process is working that way very well now. And I think this would be a pretty big thing. Also, I think where this would sell a ton is in corporate sales.
Mm-hmm.
Tons of companies buy large quantities of MacBook Airs And they also like to have a little bit bigger options. And I think if there's a 15-inch MacBook Air, they would sell so many of those in bulk to like, you know, fleet buyers. And that's another reason why I think they're not going to go super high-end with anything. I don't think they're even going to go with the Pro chip there. Again, because the purpose of the MacBook Air is large volume, inexpensive model that satisfies most people's needs. And the regular M2 does that. You don't need the M2 Pro to do that. I know right now a lot of companies do just buy a bunch of 16-inch MacBook Pros as their stock computer, but that's mostly for higher-end uses, like, you know, developers, designers, that kind of thing. Not a lot of people are buying those for their sales staff and you know, their...
The Apple's stupid price structure for the big laptops costs a ton of money was passed on to me in my corporate life because, companies in general want to offer computers to their employees. They're like, you can get a big screen or a small screen. And so with like the Dell laptops or whatever, that's what they would offer you. And yeah, the big one is a little bit more expensive, but they basically gave you a choice. Do you want it small and portable, or is it a bigger screen more important to you?
Right, because the difference was like a few $100.
Right, but with the Macs, it was this whole regimented system. And people were like, okay, well, I want a Mac, but I want one with a big screen. They're like, oh, wait a second. If you want the Mac with the big, because it's literally double the price. It's not like $100, right? If you want the one with the big screen, you have to be this level, or your boss has to approve it or whatever. And you're like, I don't care. Like, people who ask for that, they don't know or care anything about Macs. They just want a bigger laptop screen because it's easier for them to do stuff. And they work a lot on their laptops when they're not on the road even, but just in meetings and rooms. People are like, oh, why don't you just hook a monitor up? Nobody cares. Buy a cheap Dell monitor. Like, that's fine for when they're at their desk, but people are on, quote unquote, on the go, even within the office back in the day when we were all in the office, just going from conference room to conference room, and 15-inch screen is bigger. And people would request, and the companies that I work for, I want a Mac laptop and I want one with a big screen. And they got so much pushback because of Apple's stupid pricing structure. So if the 15-inch was available, corporations would snap it up because they do not want to buy... to the cheap corporations, do not want, which is most of them, don't want to buy every employee who wants one a big screen Mac laptop because they're so expensive. And honestly, employees don't need a 16-inch MacBook Pro if all they're going to do is check email all day and look at web browsers and have Excel open, right? 15-inch MacBook Air will do that perfectly.
I would go even broader than that. Almost everyone doesn't need a 16-inch MacBook Pro. Like, almost everyone's needs could be solved just fine with a 15-inch MacBook Air if it was, you know, if you maybe you bump the storage and RAM up for some people. But, you know, otherwise, like, many of us are still stuck in the old way of thinking, like, well, you know, the low-end consumer-priced, you know, entries in the Apple lineup are not suitable for if you're, you know, a video editor or, you know, a heavy coder or whatever. And that maybe used to be true. That's not true anymore. Now, almost anybody's job can be done perfectly well and not just like barely done, can be done well on a MacBook Air class processor. You actually don't, like, almost no one actually needs the larger resource. I'm very happy to keep making them. I'm going to keep buying them. But the fact is, like, if I had to do my job entirely on a MacBook Air, I could. A year ago, I did. Like, it was fine. Like, the Apple Silicon class low-end chips, quote low-end, are so good that we are not even coming close to filling that headroom and actually using it in most fields. And every year, as those chips get better and better, the number of tasks that you really benefit with the higher-end hardware for is getting smaller. So it's a very good place to be. Like, if they already, the 13-inch MacBook Air is an amazing computer for almost everything. Make it a little bit bigger and you cover way more needs, and you don't need to make the chip any faster if you don't want to.
One other thing they could do, a couple of things they could do with the 13-inch MacBook Air if they wanted, because we were talking about, oh, if they fill that space with battery, it makes it heavier or whatever. You know what you could fill that space with? I know they're not going to do this, but I just throwing that out there for Apple. I know it's too late, but 15-inch MacBook Air, plenty of room for an SD card slot. I know we were talking about, what do you get with a 16-inch? You get
that
an SD card slot.
I really would like.
You get an SD card slot and you get an HDMI port. I'm not saying on the Air put the HDMI. It might not be thick enough, right? But SD is very slim and it will fit. And if you have all that space, maybe think about that. The other thing you can do, you're not going to get the cool HDR screen on the MacBook Pros. That's part of what makes it expensive. Those are amazing screens. But the MacBook Air ships with a default resolution that's not native res for its screen. The 15-inch potentially could ship with native res for its screen instead of a scaled resolution.
No, that's a Pro thing. They're not going to do that.
I don't know. It's 15-inch, though. I'm saying, like, it's not 16-inch native resolution. It's 15-inch native res. And honestly, screens for native res 15-inch that aren't HDR, like, you're not breaking the bank on that, Apple. That is not advanced technology. That is the known quantity. You can get those screens. It's not that much more expensive. And it, because so few people even know about what we're talking about, the fact that the MacBook Air comes at non-native res out of the box, people don't even know that. So it's not even like it's a selling proposition where you're pushing people up to the high-end line for that. I just, at a certain point, not having native res even on your cheapest laptop becomes silly. We're not at that point yet, but we're getting close. And I feel like with the 15-inch MacBook Air, it's a chance for Apple to take that next step up.
So on Upgrade, when I guessed it a week, I think it was last week, we discussed this rumor about a compute card. And this, there were references for this found in the iOS 16.4 beta. And Mike and I had a conversation trying to figure out, well, what does that even mean? And I don't think we came up with any particularly great conclusions or solid conclusions. What is this about? Is this something for the Mac Pro or is this something else entirely?
So this is such an age-old rumor for Apple stuff, but I think for computers in general, because it's like a sci-fi thing, right? I remember back, I guess this was around the PowerPC time, perhaps, when the Mac was transitioning to PowerPC, and especially when like the G5 was rumored to be coming out after the G4. This is an evergreen rumor, and the idea is that it's some kind of powerful computer that gets more powerful the more kind of building blocks you buy and plug into it. And it's a thing that makes sense to non-technical people, but anyone who has ever done programming or ever studied computer science and understands just the basic theoretical limits of parallelism, and then the financial and practical limits of wide buses that are very fast and what kind of interconnects are needed between different components, it very quickly becomes the realm of fantasy to think that you're going to have just a bunch of these interchangeable modules and you'll click them together. And if you want your computer to be more powerful, you just click two more modules on and it gets twice as fast because you had two modules and you put two more and now you have four. And it's just things don't scale that way. If you look at what the speeds are in the interconnects between a computer and its caches and its memory and its SSD and how all those buses work. And the idea that you'll just make one backbone that carries everything and we'll plug things into it. And it's like, yeah, I mean, anything's possible if you give enough money, right? But not at prices consumers are going to spend. Even at the supercomputer level, this stuff is very expensive and very difficult to do in a way that the interconnect does not cause bottlenecks and give you diminishing returns. So for people, this compute card rumor, people quickly said, this is for the Mac Pro. You'll be able to buy a Mac Pro and it'll come with one M2 Ultra. But if you want it to be faster, you can buy a compute module that has another M2 Ultra. And it's like, well, if you want two computers, just get two Mac Minis. Like, I mean, do you want two computers? Because two computers sitting next to each other, unless you can split up your video render between the two of them, which is possible, you could farm out the job and blah, 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 but there is some overhead to that. You don't magically get twice as fast by putting two SoCs in there. It's like, how do they talk to each other? How do they have memory coherence? Like, this is not something new, but in sci-fi, it's cool to think that everything is modular. And if you don't have to think about what happens when you plug a module, and if you're just a user reading a book about sci-fi or whatever, you're like, oh, I'll just plug it in. And everything will be faster. But if you're someone who has to design this, you're like, oh, wait, so how does that work? Like, how do they share information and resources and IO? And how do they interact with memory? And, you've got a non-uniform memory architecture where some memory is more distant than others. And it's like overlapping cache hierarchies and cache coherence between the CPUs and how do jobs bounce around it. It's like, and on and on and on. Like, part of the reason that Apple's SoCs are as amazing as they are is because they are systems on a chip where, within that system on a chip, you've got your memory, you've got all your computing resources, you got everything locally, you know where everything is, and you can make optimize all the paths between them to be as efficient as possible because everything is close together and everything designed by the same party. Once you say, oh, there's going to be another physical box that's going to plug into a plug, now you're sipping through a straw. You're like, well, we won't make it a straw. We'll make it really wide. Well, now you're spending lots and lots of money. This compute card stuff as an idea that it's going to be a thing to make the Mac Pro faster. Daughter cards for, or whatever you want to call them, for the Mac Pro that add computing. Sure, we have that FPGA thing that did Afterburner. You can buy cards to accelerate video things. They're called video cards. I don't know if Apple will support those. We'll see. there are cards that you can plug in that will do a specific task faster, but the idea that you'll just be able to make the whole computer twice as fast by plugging in something that is basically a second Mac Pro on a card. If you plug in a second Mac Pro on a card, you've got a second Mac Pro, which is fine and well and good and probably costs you a lot of money. But that's kind of like the old like 486 card that you can plug into a Mac. Now a Mac can run Windows things. Yeah, because you plugged in a 486 PC into your Mac. So now you have two computers in one, which is great. But you didn't just make your Mac twice as fast. So I basically entirely discount the fantasy rumor of just adding resources to your Mac Pro by plugging in compute cards. I don't discount the idea of cards that you can plug in that can do a special job faster, because again, the Afterburner card does that, and there's a long history of cards that you plug into a Mac Pro that can do a special job faster on behalf of the host computer. That makes perfect sense. Even if that card has some other SoC on it, like a specially made SoC that just has neural engines all over it, right? If Apple wanted to make that, they could. And that is a reasonable application of an accelerator card, where you would farm out a job to the accelerator card. It would do the ML job. The ML card would, might even have its own memory, kind of like GPUs have VRAM or whatever. And then it would give you the result back. But the idea that there would be two peer SoCs that are exactly the same, and they would magically make your computer twice as fast, not going to happen. So don't worry about that. All that said, I don't think that's what this compute card thing is. I don't know what it is, but it's kind of related to the rumors we've heard about, like, the AR-VR headset and how whether the all the computing is going on inside the AR-VR headset, or whether, like, your phone is doing some of it, or whether there's an external compute module that you have to connect it to or something. Maybe it's some leftover from that. Maybe that's, you know, maybe the AR-VR headset will work that way somehow with a compute card that you can plug into a Mac Pro to do development work when you're projecting onto the headset. Or maybe it's something really boring that's unrelated to either one of these things. The fact that it's in the iOS 16.4 beta doesn't mean that it's a phone feature. It just means that, you know, the compute card might run iOS, because if iOS has references to compute card, iOS would have to run on the compute card, and so it would have to know about the compute card, the same way that iOS probably has references to the Studio Display, because apparently inside the Studio Display is a little version of iOS running all the speakers and the camera and all the other stuff. So I'm assuming the compute card thing is way, 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 way less exciting than people think it is. But until and unless Apple releases something related to this, we can speculate. Just try to tamp down the idea that you're going to plug modules into your Mac Pro to make it twice as fast.
Noted. I'll be aware of that when I buy my Mac Pro for $80,000.
If they ever ship it.
Yeah, and it will take, 1,500 watts to power it, because...
Small price to pay, am I right, John?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hey, so do you need us for this next thing, or can Marco and I just, like, come back in an hour?
I mean, I don't know. Like, as I said, I had a 2-day break in my COVID isolation where I could unpack all the boxes that had arrived in my house and have fun with my little project. I talked about it last week. I said, I had a bunch of boxes arrived to upgrade my sound system, but I hadn't been able to unpack them yet. And eventually I would talk about it. So I did do what I could in that 2-day period. I didn't know it was going to be 2-day period, but... practically speaking, I didn't have time to complete it, but I figure I'll just give an overview of what I did. To review, my project was upgrade my sound system, because I bought a new TV and a new receiver and a new Blu-ray player recently, and I've talked about them on the show. I didn't buy new speakers. My speakers are very old, they're very small, they're fairly cheap, and I figured every other part of my system has been updated. I should update the speakers too. And it wasn't just like, oh, I should just do it because I just need to spend money. It was... I felt like they were not holding up their end of the bargain in the television and movie watching experience. Not that they were bad, but now my TV was so much better. And the speakers, it's 4K now. My Blu-ray player is 4K. And the speakers, they're fine. It was a 5.1 system. I'll see if I can put I didn't put a link in here, Casey. But I'll see if I can find one to my 5.1 system. I think they still sell it. It's, it's pretty cheap. It comes with all the speakers you need. It comes with, front, left, right, and back surrounds, and a center channel, and a subwoofer. But they're small. These are small speakers. I like the fact that they were small, because originally I was like, oh, how am I going to even find room for 5.1 speakers in here? Is my family going to accept it? So it was good that they were small, but small also means not great sound reproduction. Obviously, none of these small speakers have any bass. That's where the subwoofer comes in. But the subwoofer trying to fill in the bass for all these tiny speakers. And practically speaking, one of the things that would always come up, and I talked about this when I was setting up my receiver, is people complain that they can't hear the dialogue. Now, that's not just my sound system. There's many articles about how sound mixing in television and movies has been making it harder and harder to hear dialogue.
I thought that your surround system with your center channel was supposed to make that a problem.
There it is.
I don't have that problem with my basic 2-channel stereo setup.
You don't watch movies or TV shows, or at least not recent ones. Yeah, the center
what are you
channel.
Talking about?
the center. You're watching sitcoms. I know you can hear the dialogue there and the laugh track. I know you're watching Last of Us with Tiff.
Yeah, I'm watching Last of Us. We're watching New Girl. That's not that old.
You're not watching Christopher Nolan movies where everybody mumbles.
No.
So the center channel, as I talked about with Bound Receiver, really does help there because you know where the dialogue is coming from. It's coming from the center channel. And what you can do what I did, which is turn up the center channel, which makes the dialogue louder than the other stuff. Because if you just turn up the volume, everything gets louder. And if it's mixed poorly, again, the problem is not necessarily the speakers involved, but if it's mixed in such a way that the dialogue is overwhelmed by the other sound effects, just turning up the volume doesn't help because it just makes everything louder. So having a center channel, you can just turn up the center channel and pretty much just the dialogue will be there. And that really does help. But it's not just that. It's not just the center channel. My center channel speaker is small. And also, but if you've seen the diagram of my room that we talked about last week, I've got two couches in my room. And when we'd have like my family was visiting for the holiday or whatever, or even just, my local family just sitting around at the various seats in the couch, especially if someone wants to lay on one couch, they take up half the couch and they have the dog with them. So two other people on the other couch, we are spread pretty widely in our weird room around the television screen. Right. And the center channel speaker is only really pointing at one person. And if you have a cheap, small center channel speaker without sort of a wide dispersion, the person who's sitting in the quote unquote good seat can hear the dialogue fine. But the people in the other seats feel like they don't hear it as well because it's the first of all, the volume is lower. And second of all, who knows which frequencies are reaching them, right? So you can turn up the volume, but then the person sitting in the good seat says the dialogue's too loud now, right? So these are the problems I was solving. Better sound system in terms of just better sound overall, right? Not, small, tiny speakers that can't reproduce lots of frequencies. And also, better dialogue, better clarity of dialogue, but also better in more seating positions, which means a speaker that is able to send the same sound information to a wide array of people, like instead of just a beam that goes straight out from the speaker, more of a fan shape, so that if you're sitting directly in front of it, offset by 5 degrees, 10 degrees, 15 degrees, it still sounds more or less the same. So these were my goals with this system. Oh, and also don't spend a lot of money, obviously. and don't be humongous, right? Because I have no place to put any speakers, let alone big giant speakers. And that was my COVID research project. And I had a tech podcast host twist thrown in here, which I can't complain about because it is my privilege to be in this position, but it was nevertheless a confounding factor in my decision-making process. A nice person who works for a speaker company passed along a friends and family discount to me for a couple of particular brands of speakers. And the discount was substantial. So now,
problem to have.
It's like those elf puzzle problems. It's like you have to find, speakers that aren't that expensive, that fit in your room, that have wide dispersion for, the center channel audio clarity, and are better than your existing ones that aren't that expensive. And oh, by the way, these particular brands are way cheaper than other ones. And it really confounded things because you can't just shop. I'll just shop based on price and features. Every time you shop based on price and features, like, oh, but is this one of those ones that cheap? Now suddenly it raises in esteem. It's like, or maybe you can shop the next level up in that product line, but maybe you should shop down and save some money and spend the money on other things that made everything so much harder for me. I know, boohoo me, you got a big discount on speakers. It must be so hard to pick, right? So one of the first things I encountered in my research was trying to find people who talk about the issues that I was saying. The centerpiece, of my system was going to be the center channel speaker. People don't think about that in a 5.1 system because they think about like the glory speakers, the left and right channel for your stereo or whatever. But when you're watching television and movies, the center channel is where it's at. Yes, all the dialogue comes through there. Lots of other sounds come through there too. It's the main sort of like central sound of the show. It's not like listening to stereo music where the left and right channels are the stars. The center channel is the star on television shows and often a lot of movies. So if you're going to spend a lot of money on your 5.1 system, do not skimp on the center channel. That is a very important channel. The thing that I found and was confirmed by a video that I'll link in the show notes is that most companies that sell speakers also believe that the left and right channel are the glory channels and do not care about the center channel. And they make weird, bad speakers for center channels compared to their stereo channels, right? Because, well, for two reasons. One, the center channels are often intended to be laid on their side for obvious packaging reasons. And that messes with speakers, especially if you're like, oh, we have our special fancy audio engineers and they made this amazing speaker for our stereo speakers, right? If you lay that speaker on its side, all of the careful, engineering they did to make the sound dispersion work is now sideways. Like it's not, it was made to be uniform at a certain height for, you know, listening for people sitting in front of them with the expectation that the speaker is vertical. But when you put that speaker on its side, now its dispersion pattern is on its side. Unless you're laying on your side as well, things aren't going to work quite the same way. So that's one problem. Second problem is center channel speakers are often smaller. Again, for obvious reasons, people need to stick them in their entertainment center. They want to put them under their TV. You can't make them 20 feet tall unless you're one of the real home audio people, like the what do you call it, home theater people. The thing that the fancy home theater people do is they do what they do at movie theaters, which is the center channel speakers are behind the screen, which is acoustically transparent, and they're like the size of refrigerators.
Wait, what?
Not, that's where
the
in
screen
the movie,
is transparent?
In a movie theater, like the movie screen in a movie theater.
Oh, right.
The speakers are behind there, right?
Right.
That's where
okay,
that's why the sound comes out of, and it's acoustically transparent, like movie projection screen, right? And people who do home theaters in their basements with projection screens, that's what they do. Because you can put huge refrigerator-sized speakers there, right? Just like a movie theater and spend lots of money. That's not me. That's not relevant to me. So center channel speakers are, oh, I have to fit this in my, you know, I have to fit this above my VCR, huh? Whatever. Above whatever you have, above my cable box or whatever. Or it has to fit underneath my, you know, right by the CV, oh, kind of like a sound bar. So when you make a center channel speaker really small like that, it's not going to be as good as your, you know, left and right speaker because the drivers on it are smaller. You can't have anything even approaching a woofer because everything is super tiny. It's kind of a mess. So this YouTube video is the problem with most center channel speakers. And it's from this audio, one of these obsessive nerdy audio reviewers that I found in my travels. And he has this really weird measuring device where he puts a speaker in the center of the room and sends this robotic arm around it that measures, you know, sound dispersion while playing test tones of various frequencies and stuff like that. And he produces these little polar coordinate graphs of sound dispersion that show, like, you know, you see these graphs in the show. I'll probably put one of them as a chapter art or link to them. They're on the web. It's not a spatial diagram. So don't picture yourself seated at the bottom of this diagram. It's polar coordinate, so it's a circular chart. And as you go from the circle to the edge, that's frequency, right? So I think the outer edge is the higher frequencies and the middle is like the base. Yeah. So at every step along that thing, it's saying, okay, if you're listening to a 200 hertz signal and you're sitting at 0 degrees, here's how strong it is, and 300 and 400 and 500 and so on and so forth, right? But still, what you want to see in this diagram is a big fan shaped region that is similarly colored that says, if you're anywhere within this fan, you're going to hear all the frequencies more or less the same way you would if you were sitting dead in front of the speaker. That is a speaker with good dispersion, and they show horizontal and vertical versions of that. And one of the ones that was used as the example in the video that was good was called the SVS Prime. SVS is a speaker brand. Prime is their product line. The SVS Prime Center had really good dispersion. And he also gave an example, if you scroll down in the show notes, you'll see this, of the Mica MB42XC as an example of a center channel with really bad dispersion. And if you compare the two diagrams, you can see, oh, wow, big difference, right? If you are sitting even, you know, 10 or 20 degrees off axis on this Mica speaker, many frequencies are just gone for you, right? Like, and important frequencies in the words of Kill Bill, frequencies that you will miss, right? Like speech frequencies or, you know, in the speech range, right? You can look at them and they're, it should be all red and dark red. Instead, it's like blue, which is like the minimum color. There are spots where they're blue, green, yellow. You're missing lots of frequencies, even if you're sitting in the seat next to the quote unquote good seat in the couch. So that's an example of a center channel with bad dispersion. And you'll not be shocked to learn that most center channels have really bad dispersion. And one of the reasons cited in the video is that most center channels, since they're laid on their side, are done with like a mid-range and then a tweeter and then a mid-range. So they look like three drivers if you take off the little speaker grill. And they're only mid-rangers instead of woofers because they're so skinny, right? So it's a tweeter right in the middle of two mid-range drivers. And the interference pattern you get from that is not great with the two mid-ranges overlapping with each other and having the typical interference pattern. He does this whole thing with the wave pool, but if you just know how, you know, two sources of waves can interact and leave like dead zones, that happens. And also, with just one tweeter, tweeters tend to be pretty directional. With just one tweeter pointed in one direction, you're missing out on all of those frequencies as well. So the SVS Prime Center was said, this is a center channel with good dispersion. But that doesn't mean the SVS Prime Center is a good speaker. It's just saying, hey, dispersion-wise, it sounds the same in all these locations. But then you get into, okay, but how good a speaker is it? How is its frequency response? How does it sound? You know, blah, 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 you know, all the speaker review stuff. So this is the rabbit hole I went down, trying to find a center channel speaker that was a good speaker, that fit in my entertainment center and that had good dispersion. And that really narrowed the field down a lot because I needed to find speakers where I could see a dispersion diagram, either from this person or another person. Lots of people do these type of diagrams, right? So I could tell what the dispersion was like. One of the things you can tell is if it's, you know, he gave all these acronyms like MTM is mid tweeter mid. You can do WMTW, where it's woofer mid tweeter mid woofer, like all these different arrangements. Most of those arrangements are bad in that you know you're not going to get good dispersion. The two arrangements that were good were one that Marco will be familiar with. The Kef brand does a thing where they do, what do they call it? Coaxial? Or
yeah, they put the tweeter inside the mid.
Exactly. So they do. It looks like it's just one speaker cone thing, but the thing in the middle is the tweeter and the thing on the outside is the mid. And that prevents like the waves overlapping in a destructive interference way because they're literally coming from the same centralized source.
Oh, it sounds so damn good. I don't know if that's why these speakers sound so damn good, but these speakers sound so damn good.
It's not necessarily a big thing about audio quality, because that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about dispersion. We're saying, if I sit 10 degrees off, does it sound more or less similar to what I'm sitting dead on? And the coaxial tweeter inside the mid or the woofer makes it sound the same, more the same, the more you get off axis. Now, whether it sounds good or not is a question of high quality speaker, whatever. So Kef speakers tend to have pretty okay dispersion, and more importantly, not a lot of dead zones where you get the destructive interference of like the tweeter and the mid or whatever, right? The other arrangement that seems to work well is a mid, and then this is what the SVS is, and then a tweeter or a woofer, and then a tweeter and a mid on top of each other vertically. Because again, stereo speakers very often have, you know, a big driver and a little one, a woofer and a tweeter above each other, like vertically. And lots of speakers are tuned to sound good that way. Stereo speakers are, you know, setting aside the Kef ones, are tuned to sound good that way. It is a common arrangement. So when you lay a speaker on its side, if you can get the tweeter and the mid still to be on top of each other, they'd be side by side if it was vertical. But when you lay it on its side, you do that arrangement. That also produces a good dispersion, at least in the SVS Prime. I forget what they call that. I think they're called like three-way or something, where it's WT/MW, because it's a woofer and then a tweeter and a mid vertically and then another woofer. That's what the SVS Prime is. And then other brands also do make conical ones. And so that really, really narrowed down the field, because pretty much every single center channel speaker is one of those, not one of those good ones. It's either Kef, which does the conical, SVS Prime, which as it turns out is not a great speaker, or the one I eventually settled on, which is from a band I'd never heard of, the ELAC UC-52.
You got an ELAC?
I've never heard of this brand. I guess you have.
Neither have I.
I haven't ever owned ELAC speakers, but they are extremely well regarded.
Yeah, so this center channel speaker has coaxial mid and tweeter in the center of the center channel speaker. It's got like two pretty large, I don't know if you call them woofers, but the center thing of it is one of those coaxial type of things. It has really good dispersion. According to the diagrams, not as good as the SVS Prime, but still pretty good. And also, it's also a good speaker. Like, it's also important. Like, you want it to be a good speaker with good frequency response and clarity and all the other crap you can read about or whatever, right? The downside is that it's
huge. Big. Yeah, I was going to say, like, I was looking at the woofers in it are 5 1/4 inch woofers. So this is a large speaker. Yeah. I have two of those in it and the mid. Like, that's...
I mean, another thing you learn about doing all the speaker research is... You see lots of pictures of speakers and they never show like anything next to them for size. So you might have in your mind how big they are. Like, there's nothing for comparison. Like, they should put like a little person or like an Apple or like a, you know, a quarter or like a MacBook Pro or something that recognizes the size of. It's like, how big is it? Because they all look small when you see them on the picture. And then you go look at the dimensions. And you're like, wait, what? That's 24 inches deep. What? The Kef speakers are a great example. Your Kef speakers are so deep.
Yes.
What is in there? Is like a little home in there for little people? I don't understand.
It's a home for acoustics, John.
It's just they're just so huge. So everything I'm looking at, I was constantly measuring, will this fit? Will this fit in at my entertainment center? The ELAC UC-52 fits in my entertainment center barely. And you know how it fits? I have to eject from the shelf that it is on both the TiVo and the Blu-ray player.
See ya.
because there's just no room for them with that stupid speaker in there. But I said, oh, this is going to be, you know, the centerpiece of my system and is literally my only option. It's this or the SVS Prime, which isn't as good a speaker. The other thing I was worried about that I talked about in Mastodon is like, people tend to advise against mix and matching different speakers on a home theater system because you have to match the timbre and it's not going to sound right and this, that, and the other thing. And it's like, okay, I did a lot of suggesting to people like, is that always terrible? Can you make that work? How bad is it? And I got varying opinions. Some people are like, oh, it's not that bad. You're not going to notice the difference. Other people are like, never do it. You should never mix. But if you don't mix, you're stuck with like every one of these manufacturers has a product line. Like, buy all our speakers from us. Here it is. Here's our 5.1 system. And people tend to review individual speakers, not entire systems. This speaker is good. This speaker is bad. Oh, and this, you know, this left and right channel are good. These surround speakers suck. This center channel sucks. That's usually the thing in the 5.1 systems. Here's this 5.1 system. The center channel sucks. Here's the 5.1 system. The center channel sucks. I found the ELAC one. The center channel didn't suck. I could have bought ELAC left and rights and ELAC surrounds, but guess what? They're huge and also very, very expensive. And by the way, ELAC is not one of the brands that I had a discount on. So I'm paying full price, baby, for the ELAC UC52. I did try to buy one on eBay. So I'm trying to bring the price down. Someone was selling the ELAC 52 for way too little money. And I lowballed them because it was like, you know, our best offer. I lowballed them by $50 and they never responded. And I felt a little bit scared even buying it on eBay because I'm like, what condition will this be in? And speakers are delicate. And my wife kind of scared me off a little bit by saying, who knows what you're going to get in the mail? That picture is really grainy. I'm like, you know what? That picture is grainy.
Well, also, like, you know, worst case, if you really hated it, you can't easily return it to just eBay, you know?
Yeah, like, what if I get this and it's, like, not worth the money, or I thought it would fit, but it really doesn't? Because remember, another thing I have to do with the center is tilt it up a little bit, because I'm putting it, like, it's right under my TV. It's as close as it can get to being under my TV, but under my TV is not where my TV is. So I have to tilt it up slightly so it aims at our faces when we're sitting on the couch. So it just barely fits.
Oh, my word.
So that was the big expense. No discount. ELAC UC52, basically my only choice. I knew I wasn't going to be able to buy other ELAC speakers because they're just too expensive and also too big to fill the other roles. So I got that. But then after that painful experience, I'm like, you know what? I need to use a discount for the rest of these speakers because I just can't. I can't continue at this pace. It's not super expensive. How much is the ELAC? It's like 400 and change or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not that bad. Like, in terms of like volume or weight, you feel like you're getting your money's worth. It's so big. I don't know what's in there, but whatever it is, it's heavy and expensive.
This is $400 worth of wood, that's for sure.
Yeah. So for the rest of the speakers, I said, okay, well, if I can't match, you know, I can't buy a full ELAC system, why don't I just at least buy matching front, left, right, and back surrounds from the same manufacturer. So at least those will all match, and I'll buy one from that I have a discount on. And so that's what I did for my front right and left and my back right and left. I bought Polk speakers because I had a discount. That is literally why, right? And they're well reviewed and they're good. And I was able to shop. What I ended up doing in Marco fashion was, rather than saving money and getting the cheap speakers with a big discount, it went up the line until the speakers that I bought with a discount were as much as I was willing to spend for the full price cheap ones. You know what I mean? So I bought the Polk R100s for my front right and left. Not just because of the discount, but also because they're bookshelf speakers, and they are among the smallest bookshelf speakers in their sort of price category. Because unlike the Kef ones, they are not 19 inches deep for some reason, right? And that was important to me getting them in the room because I have very little place for these to go, and they're like near walls and everything. Like, so I bought those, and I had to buy stands to put them on because they're bookshelf speakers and I wanted them to be at the right level. And the stands were also expensive and I didn't get a discount on them. I'm like, maybe I'm Casey. I need to get a discount on everything. If I get a discount on it, I'll buy it. For the back surrounds, I bought the very poorly reviewed Polk XT15 back surround speakers. But honestly, I don't care because they're back surround speakers.
Yeah, who cares?
They are bigger. They're undoubtedly better than my past speakers, for sure. They are bigger than my past speakers, but so far, they have passed the spousal approval. I mean, not approval. She said disapproving things about them when I was setting them up, but didn't demand that I take them down immediately. And I feel like you'll get used to them. They're small.
If they aren't immediately rejected, you're in a good place.
Yeah, they are bigger than they were, but they're as small as I could get. Instead, I wanted them to be better than my other ones. My other ones were so tiny, and these are okay. So there, I've got my five speakers here on my expensive center and my poke right and left and back right and left. And then I need subwoofer. And here is where, so it's like I've got Casey on one shoulder saying, buy a Polk subwoofer, you got a discount. Right? And I've got Marco saying, don't buy it just because you have a discount. Get a good subwoofer.
No, that's not, you haven't asked me this question yet. I love having subwoofers. The difference between a great subwoofer and a cheap subwoofer is not as big as the other speakers involved. It is a much smaller difference, and you get.
Well, you haven't been reading audio. The audio reviewing world disagrees with you strongly.
There's different characteristics. One thing I love is a force canceling subwoofer. I've mentioned before the Sonos sub is one of those. I've never admitted this before in public. I think only Ben Thompson knows this until this moment. But I have a small KEF subwoofer under my desk for my computer subwoofer, and it was absurdly expensive.
I know which one you got.
I got the smallest
because
one.
Because I looked at all the reviews for it, and yes, it was, but it's made of aluminum. It's really heavy. It's actually pretty good.
And it's force canceling. And before this, I had some inexpensive one from Amazon, one of those brands that had some kind of hipster name that like seemed like it would be fancy, and you get it, and it's just like particle board, and it's just crap.
Do you remember which one it was? Because now I know every subwoofer in the world.
I'd have to look it up, but I sent it back to Westchester, and it's waiting in a closet to be used for something. But that one, it was just too like boomy. It didn't have
find out which one that is because I may want to buy it from you.
I wouldn't recommend it.
I know. I'll get to that in a second. But yeah, so the one you were describing, you said it's force canceling. I believe they mostly describe it kind of Subaru fashion. Oh yeah, okay, I know Kanto. And I know the subs. It's not that bad, but the KEF one is way better. It's a good sub. But like, I believe the KEF one, they describe it in Subaru fashion as essentially horizontally opposed, and because that's what it is. If you look inside, it's horizontally opposed drivers, but not necessarily force canceling in the same way as the Sonos one is. It's still a very good sub.
No, it is. It's the way they don't use that term, but it's the same design. It's the same thing. And there's a couple others on the market that are force canceling, but it's very, very few.
The other thing about the KEF one that definitely recommends it is it's good sub and also very small for how good it is. That is the key. Very, very small. That's why I was looking at that one until I saw the price, then ran away.
Yeah. It also it has a bunch of adjustments on the back. So, not only every decent subwoofer will have like the crossover and level adjustments in the back, but because that tells how much, what frequencies to play through the subwoofer and how loudly. Those are very important. But the KEF also has all different adjustments for things like little EQ profiles to know how much bass do you want, how boomy do you want it to be, how strong do you want it to punch or whatever. And I found that it was weird, like when I was using the cheaper subwoofer. It's under my computer desk. This is where I listen to music mostly, so it's under my desk. And when I was sitting in my chair, the volume it would take to sound good at my chair level above the desk, and therefore the desk is between the subwoofer and me. At that same volume level with the cheap subwoofer, somebody sitting on the chair, like the kind of like lounge chair behind me, they had a kind of a more direct earshot to it because the desk wasn't blocking it as much. And it sounded way too boomy if you were like not sitting in the desk. And for whatever reason, whatever the design was, that's how the cheap one sounded. And then when I upgraded to the KEF, that problem went away, and I was able to get a pleasing subwoofer strength at desk level that didn't also sound super boomy to the rest of the room. So that there's lots of advantage to this. People in apartments like them because you can make them like less boomy down low, and make it transmit less to your neighbors. I love this ridiculous subwoofer, but it is so expensive. And I didn't even pay full price. It was on sale one day and I picked it up, but it was still like, I can't believe I spent this much on a subwoofer. But there is a difference in those ways. That being said, I paid almost twice as much as whatever I paid for the Sonos sub a million years ago. And the Sonos sub has many of those same benefits. Much of the same quality. The only downside of that is that the Sonos sub has no line in. You can only use it with a small number of Sonos products.
I did look at the Sonos sub until I realized, hey, what am I doing? I can't use this.
Yeah. It's the not Sonos a stereo sub component. It is great. And it's great for its price. But yeah, you can only use it with a Sonos amp or a couple of Sonos soundbars.
You know, so if this is the correct subwoofer for the KC62, which looks to be okay, I can tell you that it is very neat that on the back, the EQ slider is for room, wall, corner, cabinet, or apartment, which I really enjoy.
Yes, it's so good.
I really dig that. But also, I can tell you why Marco Arment bought this subwoofer. And it is because there are four dip switches on the back. Why are they there? Who knows? But that is huge Marco energy to be able to fiddle with dip switches in the back of a subwoofer. So
it's the
I understand
high-pass
now.
Filter. That's why it says HPF above it.
Ah, I didn't even notice that. Yes, yes, yes. Fair enough. That is very funny.
So that KEF subwoofer falls into the category of subs that are kind of made for, they say it like for stereo use. And what they mean is if you're hooking this up to, if for example, you have bookshelf speakers and you're connecting your phonograph, Casey, to it or whatever.
or your Mac. That's what mine is. I have two
exactly right.
Like if, a subwoofer as a footrest and a bass.
If you're in a scenario where you have stereo sound and you want to augment the stereo sound with a subwoofer because your speakers don't have giant woofers on them, like that's what this is for. And a breed of subwoofers have features that are like, hey, we'll sound good in that scenario because we have all sorts of stuff in the back of the sub lets you tweak the way it's blended with the other speakers. For home theater applications, the receiver does all that, right? And so you don't need those features in the back. In fact, when you're in a home theater scenario, what they tell you to do for your subwoofer is the crossover, just set it to maximum because you're not you're telling the sub, just play what you get. And the actual crossover is done in your receiver and it figures out the correct cost crossover with your speakers through sound calibration, all that crap, right? Like that. The receiver has the smarts, so it just needs a sub to essentially be dumb speaker. So it was good that I could shop in the category of subs that are less expensive because they don't have like fancy iOS app controlled DSPs to adjust. Like that's all in my receiver. I already paid for that, right? That's all in my Dirac, blah, blah, blah. Like, so the smarts are there. This just needs to be dumb. The thing with subwoofers though, as I was talking about Marco's small one, the reason I was looking at that one, I don't have a lot of room for a subwoofer. Because I don't have a lot of room for anything in this room. I don't have a lot of room physically. I don't have a lot of room family-wise. Family-wise, because, I mean, one of the good things about the Sonos sub is it's relatively small. Like, you can hide it somewhere. You can tuck it behind something. Quote-unquote good subs tend to be large. Larger than you think. Larger than anybody wants in their house, unless you have, like, a dedicated theater room where you can hide it with a plant or something, and I couldn't do that, right? My existing...
Actually, they make good plant stands. Like, my Sonos sub upstairs here... I believe it has two plants on top of it, and because it's just a big rectangle. And actually, the little KEF one, the top is a little too rounded. You can't really put stuff on top of it. But I mean, it's fine. It's a footrest.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of marshmallowy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But
although you should not put
great, nice flat top.
Don't put anything on top of a sub unless it is force canceling / horizontally opposed, because otherwise it will shake off.
That's yes, exactly. Put your crystal collection up there.
Yeah, so my previous sub, because it was part of the world's tiniest 5.1 system, was, I mean, not tiny, but I came to think of like, oh, this is how big subwoofers are, so I'll just find one that's the same size. The answer is no, you won't. Like, the KEF is actually smaller, but almost every other subwoofer is bigger. And that led me down the very quickly diverging fork in the road of subwoofers, which is sealed versus ported. Sealed subwoofer is a subwoofer that has a big giant speaker cone in it, and it looks like a giant speaker with a big giant speaker cone, right? Ported looks like a big giant speaker cone, but there's a hole in the speaker. Lots of speakers are ported. If you see a stereo speaker and there's a hole in the front or the back of it, that is a port. It allows air to flow in and out. In subwoofers, the ports are tuned to be resonant at a particular frequency. It makes the subwoofer more powerful at lower frequencies. Ported subwoofers tend to go louder, lower. Some people might say they tend to be boomier. It depends on how you adjust them. But most importantly, ported subwoofers are bigger because ports take up space, because the ports in a subwoofer are not just like little tiny slots like they are sometimes in a speaker, or one little tiny quarter size hole like they are in a bookshelf speaker or something. The ports are big. They take up room. There's a plastic tube in there for air to go down that is a particular length and shape tuned for its use. And so ported subwoofers are the size of mini fridges. They're just massive. And I could not fit one in my room, despite the fact that my cheapo sub from my existing 5.1 was a ported sub, but it was a ported sub with an 8-inch driver in it. And, you know, 8-inch driver is not big for a subwoofer. Like, right? You can find, you know.
I would call that mid-sized for us. I mean, you could get the bigger, but, like, I mean, look, my little Kef one's only 6.5,
I know.
Well,
that's part of why the Kef one is Sonos, so expensive and amazing.
Yeah, I think the Sonos is also 6.5-inch, something like that. But, right, I mean, typically, I mean, that's fairly small for a subwoofer driver.
That's why the Sonos and the Kef get such gurus. Like, can you believe this thing has this much bass and it has a 6-inch driver? That's maybe why it costs so much money, but it's also why they get such good reviews. It's like, wow, they managed to get good bass, good clean bass out of us. And when we say clean, we mean that if you look at the frequency response diagram, it's not just like a giant peak around the resonant frequency of the port and then, you know, really low everywhere else. Sealed subwoofers, on the other hand, are much easier to make behave like a regular speaker. Some people call them more musical, quote unquote, although you'll find many debunking videos in this, is saying like, look, it's just a big speaker and it can have a frequency response that is flat within the range that it is used, or flat-ish within the range that it's used. So if you're using it to augment, if you're listening to music and using a subwoofer to augment the low frequencies because your bookshelf speakers have smaller drivers, get a sealed sub because you won't have any boominess and it will blend in nicely with your speakers. But for my purposes, the important thing is that sealed subwoofers are way, 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 way smaller. So I had a choice. Can I find a ported subwoofer that has good reviews and has good sound that I can fit in this spot? Or can I find a sealed one that I can put there that takes about the same amount of room? Polk and the other brands I discounted on did have subwoofers that were, I think they had both ported and sealed. No, I think mostly just ported. And they were all bigger, and they weren't particularly well reviewed. And I said, you know what? I want to get a good subwoofer, and I want it to be small. And one of the most popular subwoofer brands is the aforementioned SVS. And they make a 12-inch sealed subwoofer that has good reviews, has good frequency response, doesn't have any features that I don't need, because they make a pro version that has a bunch of features that I don't care about that costs like $100 more. It's like, great, I can save money. I don't need the iOS app and all the DSP stuff. I got my receiver. Let me get the cheap one. I didn't know if I would like or not like a sealed subwoofer, but I'm like, I can't argue with the sizing. And it's a well-regarded brand. Like, it's good brand and good reviews. I'm like, okay, that's what I'm going to do. So I got the SVS SB1000, which I don't even think they make anymore. I think they just make the Pro. But the Pro is just basically this with like an iOS app and some more fancy like buttons on the back. It's basically the same physically. And it fits where my old sub went. And I have to say that I can definitely tell the difference between a sealed versus ported sub, because unlike when you're listening to music, where the sealed sub is great, when you're watching movies, that boominess that people complain about, sometimes in a movie, you kind of want that. If you've been in a movie theater, seeing an action movie, you're hearing some boominess. Is that perfect and ideal? And if you measured it in a microphone, be like, oh, it's too boomy. The bottom line is that's what movie theaters sound like. There are resonances. The room amplifies certain frequencies. You find boominess, and part of the experience of movies is very often that big, low rumble. And a single 12-inch sub just does not have the rumble that a 8-inch ported sub did. And I could tell that it's cleaner. I can tell that it's better. Music sounds way better. And in fact, most of the audio sounds better. And the 12-inch sub does go down to the same frequencies as a ported sub. It just doesn't have as much oomph down there, and there's no like resonance at the port level, right? So, and the SBS, by the way, wasn't cheap. I think it was more expensive than my center channel ELAC thing.
Oh wow!
Although no, I bought it from their outlet store in Casey Power.
That's right. That's right.
Find a bar, because I was like on the shop in the outlet store. Find the ones. SBS is so cruel though. They sell all their speakers in like, kind of like a faux wood finish, and also a like glossy piano black or piano white, and they charge $100 more for the glossy finish. It's such an Apple move, such like maybe a Porsche move. Like $100, really? Different finish on the speaker is plus $100 on a $400 product.
That's amazing.
So I bought the cheap. I bought the cheap wood grain black one from the outlet store. It's, you know, factory refurbished, you know, 5-year warranty. Like it is from the brand. So anyway, that's what I got. The good thing is my fancy receiver, like most decent receivers, can support more than one subwoofer. That's why I was asking Marco about his. I still have, and Mother Mun subwoofer is often recommended because you get all sorts of dead spots in the room. That's when you were forgetting, like when I sit in this chair with the subwoofer, it's too loud. subwoofers definitely, so if you just have one subwoofer in a room, there are going to be spots in that room that are way louder or way less loud than other spots. It's just, it's inevitable, right? Having multiple subwoofers is a way to kind of fill that in, to try to make it more even, right? So you can have two subwoofers at less volume than you have the one, and you'll have a more even distribution of, you know, where the subwoofer goes. So I did try hooking up my old 8-inch ported sub in addition to the sealed one. That definitely brings back the boom, let me tell you. And so you kind of get the best of both worlds. I was using Top Gun Maverick as my test thing or whatever, and that was a great demonstration that I spent a bunch of money on my speakers and they sound better, like for movies, for, you know, Top Gun Maverick, you know, jet planes flying overhead, missiles are going off, there's music, right? And I also played a bunch of, music on from Apple Music. I played the a couple of the newly released singles from bands that I like that were in like Dolby Atmos multi-channel, and that sounded surprisingly good in a way. You know, I hate spatial audio listening through AirPods, but the like the tracks that are mastered for multi-channel audio playing on my multi-channel system sounded really good. And then I played some stereo tracks too to hear like the front and left to right and getting filled in by the sub. So overall, I'm pretty happy with the sound, but I feel like there's more I need to do with the bass. So, you know, I did find cleverly, secretly, don't tell my wife. Oh no, she's listening to this now. She's going to know. But she, I have to say, she didn't find the subwoofer that hid in the room, the second subwoofer that I hid in the room. So I feel like if you didn't find it, once you find it, can you really complain that you don't want it there because you didn't even find it? Anyway, I do have a place for the second subwoofer, but my second subwoofer is, you know what, 10, 15 years old, very cheap, and it makes a very low humming noise when it's plugged in.
Oh no. That's now, no good.
It has always made now,
is
that
it like,
noise.
Is it like a 60 hertz ground loop kind of hum, or is it just like you know, just amplifier noise?
I know what you're talking about. I don't know enough to know if I could say. I don't have perfect pitch when it comes to the ground loop hum.
I don't know if that... You can't mistake it, you know, when you hear that sound.
It is. I think that's what it is. I can record it and see for sure, but I think that's what it is. And it has always made that sound, and the volume is really low. And because it is like on the floor behind stuff, you tend not to hear it. And I've never mentioned it to anyone, but it does make that sound. And I was happy to get my fancy new sub, which does not make any noise when it's plugged in. Like good audio components shouldn't, as you know, would imagine. And I was like, wow, it'll be great to have that hum gone, right? And also, by the way, my wife did notice this. When you adjust the volume on the receiver, occasionally the old sub would make a little boop, boop every time you went the volume go up and down, right?
Oh, that's
like from interference or
who the hell knows? It's really old. It's really cheap. Like, it's not super high quality component. You know, like, it has had years of good service, right? But she did notice recently that it's been doing that. It's probably been getting worse over time. So I don't want to have my old sub hooked up to my fancy new system. So I thought maybe I could just like flick it on when we watch movies and then turn it off. But it makes the hum whenever it's plugged in, even when it's turned off, which again, lends credence to the theory that it's, you know, ground loop 60 hertz hum type stuff. Yeah. So I am looking for a cheap, small ported sub that fits where this one is currently hidden to augment my good fancy 12 inch sealed sub. So the project's ongoing. And by the way, calibration wise, I did a very rough calibration and then got COVID again and had a COVID resurge in my body and had to retreat back to my room. So I haven't even fully calibrated this, and I've learned a lot more about calibration, most of which is confusing and sad. But anyway, so that's the story of my setup here. If you take anything from this, please look in the show notes to links to these various audio forums and review things I've seen. In particular, the problem with center channel speakers video is worth watching, because this is something I had never heard people talk about before. And the reasoning and science behind it and the pervasive acceptance of it within audiophile circles led me to believe that it's not just one person's vendetta, but it is just a problem with the industry, which is no one cares about center channels. The audiophiles don't care about it. It's just the home theater people, and the home theater people are pissed that they can't find good center channel speakers. Right? although it's not that you can't find good, like they're ones with good spread, there are more of them if you're willing to buy something the size of like a small child. Like they get so big. And I always thought to myself, where are people putting these? And then I watched all the YouTube videos of these audiophiles doing it. They put them on like, not on milk crates, so basically on milk crates in front of their giant screens. Like it's like a small child sat on top of its own private piece of furniture, tilted up, and they're so huge you can't put them in any kind of cabinet. They're like bigger than my XDR, like in terms of width, and then they're really deep, and they're just so. I mean, if you think about it, when you go to the movie theater, do you ever look on the wall and look at those speakers and think about how big they are? That's what people are putting in their homes, right? And just picture one of those on its side. Even Monoprice makes this like massive center channel that if you look at it, you're like, oh, that looks slim. You could fit that. No, it literally does not fit in any of my furniture. It's just they're just huge. So you can get good center channels, but not if you're like a reasonable person who wants to not have a little altar for your speaker in front of your television. Again, my room is not a home theater room. It is just like the main living room of my house. So I can't do that. So anyway, check out the center channel speaker. Check out the different measurements that they do on it and understand what they're talking about. And it is like kind of a bad spot in the market. And once you go through down that rabbit hole, it is fun to look at like, you know, whatever speakers you're looking for, if you're looking for bookshelf speakers or like computer speakers or whatever, to see what the options are. Because there are a lot of surprisingly good options for not that much money that are going to be a million times better than whatever you're using now. And then if you want to go whole hog, you could get something like Marco did with that fancy little tiny sub. Like it's good that stuff like that exists because, you know, there are people trying to fill this market of like, so you want good sounding speakers for your computer? And you don't want them to be like you're having two mini fridges on your desk, huh? You know, but people are willing to find them. Like even like, what do you have KEF speakers on your computer?
I have the Q150s here, and at my TV, I have the Q350s. Now, in their defense, they are not made to be used this way.
No, they're not. Like Marco is doing a little bit overkill, but even the 150s, I feel like that is not that big. Like you can fit them on a desk and not feel ridiculous.
Yeah, the
right?
Depth is what really the depth is
right.
And,
but
and you know, and,
but a desk has
and
depth,
speaker,
right?
Yes, but like the, like it's funny, like you know when you actually look at you know speaker audition rooms and high end stereo stores and everything, they're placed way out from the wall. That's how most speakers are designed to be. You know, at least a foot away from the wall.
Well, it depends if they're ported, and it depends if they're rear ported or front ported.
True, but like most good speakers are designed to have a decent amount of space between them and the wall behind them. And in reality, nobody has the room for that in their rooms, and so nobody ever.
Well, the home theater people do, because you see where they port them, and they're like, that's like 3 feet from the back wall. It's like, yeah, this whole room is just for theater. And they have them on stands and stuff like that. Yeah, so the KEF ones actually were one of the brands.
Always tells me, please before you write in, I know. On my desk, I'm supposed to be using studio monitors. I know that. I don't care. I love the way the Q150s sound, and I know it's not correct, but it's what I like. So you're going to have to deal with it.
KEF was one of the brands. They said that you can basically back all the way up against the wall, the non-ported KEF speakers, that you maybe it's because the cases are so big that no matter how far you push them against the wall, they're not really that close to the wall. But that was one of the selling points. Yeah, so... I did actually overbuy some stuff because I didn't know if I was going to like the ELAC or whether it would fit. So I also bought a Polk center channel, which as it turns out, I think I'm not going to use because I think I do like the ELAC one. So I will probably be returning and or reselling that one.
Well, I'm glad you're happy. I'm glad you've gone down this road. My goodness, what a journey though, as it always is. And we didn't even prepare the way. We skipped all that.
I won't talk about this now, but I'll save it for a future episode. The project is not done. I have the speakers on stands. I have the speakers on stands, but they're not supposed to be on stands. It's supposed to be a piece of furniture that one of them is supposed to go on that's going to hold my Blu-ray player, which can no longer fit them. You know, like there's a whole, you know, tile puzzle thing going on there. But the piece of furniture is the wrong height, so I have to cut it down. So I have to go to Home Depot to buy some threaded rod and cut it with a hacksaw. And like, that's all.
That's all
in the future. I'm still working. And then calibration. Oh, calibration. Plus with the multi-subs. There'll be more updates in this future. But anyway, I just wanted to fill everyone in. I did get new speakers. They do sound better. My journey continues.
I am very happy for you. I think we're done at this point. Hi, Future Marco.
Yeah,
wow. Hi.
Yes, definitely.
I think we're done. Okay.
Thanks to our sponsors this week, Trade Coffee and Collide. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join at atp.fm/join. We will talk to you next week.
I have to thank the person who gave me the discount. I did thank them over email and everything. But thank you again. It did, despite my complaining about, I have all these discounts, I don't know what to do. And despite the fact that it basically... led me to buy all Polk speakers. In the end, they're good speakers. Like there were discounts on good, reputable brands. So I'm very happy with the speakers I got, and I don't know what I would have done with the discount. I would probably still be fretting.
Yeah, I mean,
if we know any KEF sales reps, let me know.
Once I had the discount, I was like, hey, does anyone have an SVS discount? Because those subs are expensive. I was like, I'm just getting mad with discount power. There are, like, to Marco's point, you bought yours on sale. A lot of times speakers do go on, like, very deep sale. Or in the case of SVS, you can shop in their outlet store, and it's, like, hundreds of dollars off stuff for, like, open box or, like, factory refurbished or whatever. If it's from the manufacturer and they guarantee it, like as just same as a new product, there's not a lot of risk in buying it, and you save a lot of money.
Yeah, even just like on Amazon, sometimes like the KEF speakers, you'll occasionally catch them on sale on Amazon for like 40% or 50% off. Like I don't know why, and they're legitimate. Like because
they have huge margins. That's why.
Yeah, I guess that's why.
Yeah, and KEF speakers are expensive, but yeah, that's why you will actually find them discounted, especially if you like buy like last year's model, like the new one comes out and it's got a different piano black finish or whatever. Get the last year's one; they're still good speakers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, similarly for me, and I think I kind of made the passing mention of this on the show when I was talking about my Sonos setup, but I was able to get a steep discount on my Sonos stuff, and that's why I was able to go hog freaking wild. Like, there was no way that I was going to spend the kind of money I spent, which I mean, I think the full retail price for my setup was something like $3,000-ish, and I spent way less than that, way, way, way less than that. So I was very lucky, and I am very appreciative to the person that was able to score that for me. So I can totally sympathize with people. You know, if you're paying full price for all this stuff, which I do for almost everything I buy, I just happen to get lucky on the Sonos stuff, it gets expensive fast. Like home theater stuff, I don't know if you've noticed, John, but home theater stuff gets pricey quick.
But other things, like you can't, like it's best to just wait. Like don't wait for like Black Friday or whatever. Like wait for that particular brand of speaker to go on sale, because it's not like, you know, even the friends and family discount that I described. When you get an Apple friends and family discount, it's like, you know, 5% off, $50 back on your phones. Like it's like, you know, it's not nothing, but it's not significant. Whereas the friends and family discounts on these speakers, or even just the sale price on Amazon when they want to clear inventory, it's so much less than the regular price. It feels like no one should ever pay full price for speakers, but just wait for them to go on sale, because the discounts are so big, and their discounts don't make any sense, because like the new model, the speaker comes out, it's not twice as good. Like pay half the price when they go on, you know, 50% off sale when the new speaker comes out. After reading reviews, obviously, and blah, blah, blah.
I will say, though, one nit I have to pick with you, John, on this topic is people, and maybe I think it's mostly your fault by constantly telling me how good a Center Channel is, but people keep telling me from you to our friend Ben Thompson to many others, oh, just try a Center Channel. You got to try it. Because I have the Sonos amp set up and the Sonos sub, what it would take for me to try a Center Channel. So I have
I know the situation
amp powering two Q350s, and a Sonos sub. There is no way to use the Sonos sub with any left and right channel speaker setup, as far as I can tell. Because the only things that can power it are the Sonos amp, which only supports left and right channels and no center, or a Sonos soundbar. And as far as I know, you can't connect separate left and right speakers to a Sonos soundbar. You can't
That's
even
correct.
Use Sonos' own wireless, but you can use them as rears. Like, if you have a Sonos soundbar, you can get two other Sonos speakers and use them as rears, but you can't use them as front, left, and rights. So
that's one of the things, by the way.
It's the most frustrating limitation.
I think your KEF does this. One of the features that a lot of subs have is they say basically, hey, just send me the sub, your left and right channels, as well as the sub, and then you connect your left and right speakers to the sub.
Yeah.
So Sonos could have done that if it wanted. Like, lots of subs do that because, like, we know you don't have a way to connect all this stuff up. So just send all the music to the sub, and the sub with its fancy stuff will figure out how to distribute the audio, and then your left and right will be connected to the sub. But yeah, Sonos, there was the interview with like the CEO of Sonos talking about their new speakers that actually have line in on them, because what they basically said is, hey, people are buying record players like dummies, and they want to connect
Would
their record
stop?
Players. And they want to connect their record players to, their speakers. And the record players, like, you can buy like a Bluetooth dongle and stuff like that, but people say, hey, I have this phono output, can I just plug this into your speaker? And so the latest Sonos speakers actually do have a line in on them. Still, they're not like stereo components.
Well, they probably don't have phono preamps, though.
Yeah, yeah. I think they do. I think they said specifically that whether it figures out or there's a switch, you know, yeah. What we're talking about is the record players, because they're record players and super old, put out output at a different level than you get from other sources. So your thing that is getting the input needs to know, hey, this is phono input. This is from a phonograph. This is from the 1900s, right?
Yeah, well, because what most people don't know is that record players did not output regular line level audio the way we know it, at, you know, in more modern mm-hmm. terms. They have, like, records had were mastered with a special EQ that basically reduced the version of the sound that's encoded on the record has way less bass, because large bass frequencies encoded there would actually make the needle jump out of the track. And so they called it the RIAA curve, and they had this whole, like, custom EQ curve that records were pressed in, and then the record player would, or the amp you were running it through, would run it through a circuit that would undo that curve and make
it would try to fix it. Because if you listen to the audio as it comes out of the record player, it would sound even worse than it actually does.
Yeah, like if you put your ear up to the needle as it's moving, you can hear this, like, little mm-hmm. tiny tinny version of it, and like mm-hmm. it sounds horrendous, like, you know, if you actually amplify that. And so there's a you can't, if you just take the raw output from a record player and plug it into a regular amp, it won't sound right. You need a special phono preamp that does that conversion. And so I'll look it up. I wonder if the new Sonos Era speakers actually have that.
He specifically said it. He said it was for that. It could be that he's assuming people, modern record players, have line level out.
That's
on them.
That's the thing. So yeah, if you go out today and buy like a modern hipster record player, first of all, they all have Bluetooth in them. But second of all, they also all have built-in phono preamps. So this is not a thing you have to worry about with quote new record players. But if you have like your parents' old record player from the 1960s and 70s, like this, you will have to deal with this.
Yeah. On the flip side of that, fancy receivers still have phono input that understands, like, actual phono input for like that has not gone away. That is still a component of all, like, top of Navy gear. Yeah, but Marco, you and I are in opposite situations. I couldn't look at the Sonos sub, even though it is small and is a good sub and it would fit, because how the hell am I going to hook that up? And you can't look at center channels, because how the hell are you going to hook that up? Sonos is a separate world.
Like, for me to try a center channel, I would have to buy a receiver, like, and redo that whole setup.
Yeah,
like,
or a different sound bar.
I couldn't use the Sonos amp or the mm-hmm. Sonos sub anymore. I have to get rid of both of those components. Yep.
Replace
them with the receiver, which would be this giant thing that would take up more space, would have its own remote, would have its own controls. Like, that's why, like, I love my setup. It's super simple. Like, that's the Sonos amp does not have a remote control. It just takes volume from the TV through HDMI eARC or whatever. And so it, like, volume's controlled by the TV. It automatically switches inputs. Like, it's wonderful. It's like the small box allows me to plug in passive bookshelf speakers and a wireless sub into almost directly into my TV. Like, it's wonderful. And so, yeah, to try a center channel would be somewhat involved.
I mean, you could get a Sonos soundbar, and then you would... Oh, no, you wouldn't be able to use your left and right channels.
I know how much Marco loves soundbars. Yeah, that's the other thing people complain about. In general, soundbars demand to be your left and right. They're like, no, I'm a soundbar. I will not be your center channel.
Yeah. Well, because then that ruins the illusion that they're anything but a trumped up center channel.
Yeah. I mean, that's the part of the problem. I mean, the center channel, the soundbar and center channels have some of the same problems, that soundbars have to be slim to fit where they fit. And that means the drivers in them need to be small. And that means they need to be augmented by a subwoofer. And it's difficult. At least subwoofers are not, soundbars at least are engineered to try to sound good, because it's not like they're an afterthought. That's the whole product. The soundbar is the product. So they try to make them sound good. Whereas center channels in 5.1 or 7.1 or whatever systems, it's always just like an afterthought speaker. It's almost like kind of like the Mac Pro, where they didn't want to spend the engineering resources. All the resources go to the left and right, you know, things, the big tower speakers, like to get them to sound good, to get them to have a good dispersion pattern with no dead zones and carefully tuned or whatever. And then they say, okay, we need a speaker for the center. Slap something there. And before you ask, one of the things people think is like, well, what if you just take a left or a right speaker, like one of the good ones of the engineer, and lay it on its side? That tends not to work well, because again, the dispersion pattern is made for it to be vertical. Once you lay it on its side, it makes everything all cattywampus. But I did look into it. The other problem is that even bookshelf speakers are pretty darn big. And so at least center channels tried to be slimish. Like a bookshelf speaker that had the drivers at the size of my center channel does laid on its side wouldn't fit because they would arrange them differently there. So just a tough situation.
Real-time follow-up to go back to the Sonos line-in discussion. Yeah, I was thinking about it, and I was like, I feel like I had to cross this Rubicon at some point. And so I'm looking at my Sonos port, which is not the same as the speakers, but presumably...
It's an amp without the amp.
Yeah, exactly. And when I was setting up the turntable coming into the port, because the port has in and out, and so the port is what's also driving my porch speakers, well, via... And the port drives the amp, which drives the outdoor speakers. Well, anyways... In the port settings, there's line in, which you know, you can set what the name is and whatnot. And you can also set the source level, which runs from low, level one, which is labeled as low. Two is considered AV component. Four is labeled as AirPlay. Six is labeled as Mac computer. There's all 1 through 10. Eight is labeled as portable player or PC. And 10 is high. And you can set the source level based on that. So I think it basically can be either phono in, well, or regular.
But you're talking about levels versus the actual EQ change. Like that's if it does not say it has a phono preamp, it doesn't.
Oh no, that's a fair point. Yeah, I'm honestly not sure. I'm trying to look at the documentation.
Yeah, I mean, the Sonos stuff is not AV equipment. Every AV receiver has a phono input, which is hilarious when you see all the stuff at the back, but they all have it because it's just like that's the same reason they have giant knobs in the front. It's like it's just what you do.
Yeah, and that's the whole world that I don't want to be in if I don't need to be.
Yeah, the world of receivers, it's better than it was. I mean, the receiver I got wasn't that expensive, and it has like every feature under the sun. I could have gotten a worse receiver and still been fine. I just wanted to have a little overhead. Setting aside the inability to buy receivers at all, because apparently they couldn't manufacture them, and there's a lot of consolidation in the industry, and there's definitely room for improvement there, but they're way better than they were when I bought my last receiver, when it was still like the Stone Age, where like the on-screen displays look like VCRs from like the 1980s. Yeah. They are better than that. Mine isn't much better than that. Some of them are. Like Sony actually finally made a new receiver. Like you thought Sony was out of the Blu-ray player business and the receiver business, but suddenly, after I think it might be 10-year gap, some insane year gap, they made a new receiver. And it's good. Surprise. Modern technology. You can make a better receiver than you made 10 years ago. Congratulations, Sony.
Who would have thought it?
The other thing I didn't mention is I put banana clips on everything.
Nice.
Oh, how did that go?
It's pretty well. Like I also bought new speaker wire. I didn't want to rewire everything because I don't know, I'm just crawling around whatever. And basically, I didn't rewire.
Never contacted oxygen. You know, mined from the depths of the
no,
sun.
No. So when I bought the new ones, I'm like, look, I want better speaker wire. Mostly because I was talking about like how I'd made the runs too tight and there wasn't a lot of slack, and I wanted to fix that problem. And it's like, well, while I'm there, I should get better wire because I had like I had 18 gauge. Maybe it was 16, I forget, but it was cheap speaker wire. But I decided to rewire, but I didn't rewire everything. So I didn't rewire the back surrounds because, again, who cares? They're small speakers, and I didn't want those are the wires that run the longest, and I have to move the most furniture. So I didn't rewire those, but I rewired my front left and right and my center. And my sub already had a big, thick, you know, sub speaker going to it, so that was fine. And I bought wire with like a sheath on it for in-wall use. Even though mine aren't in the walls, just because the sheath was white and it would blend with my baseboard that's also white instead of being like, you know, speaker wire color, speaker wire brown. It could be the same color as your own house for all we know. Right. Speaker wire brown does not blend with my baseboard. It does blend with my hardwood floors. But anyway, so I bought white sheathed 14 gauge wire, which is probably overkill for speakers that are like 3 feet from my TV, but whatever. And then I rewired everything, and the wire is thicker. Obviously, it's 14 gauge. As the gauge number goes down, the wire gets thicker, and it's got the sheath on it. But it let me sort of get clean connections to the new banana clips, and that all worked out pretty well. I'm happy that I did the banana clips because now I can easily connect and disconnect the speakers, and I don't have to worry about like metal fatigue slowly making them come undone because they're screwed into these little posts or whatever. And I put banana clips on the back surrounds as well, so that was a big upgrade.
Nice.
I highly endorse banana clips.
My recommendation for people's speaker wire needs is the first time you need to make your own speaker wire length for whatever reason, just go buy a spool.
Yeah, that's what I bought. I bought a spool.
Yeah, buy a spool of inexpensive, cheaper, you know, speaker wire, you know, Amazon, Monoprice, whatever. You will never need more than that. Like, that will last the rest of your life.
unless you're me, because that's part of the reason my runs were too short. I measured for my 5.1 system when I first installed it. I measured 15 times. I'm like, this will be enough wire. But it's kind of like, the shore of England or whatever, shore of Scotland. It's got lots of little kinks in it. And so you're measuring all this stuff and you think you measured it all, but did you account for the vertical runs? Did you account for how far it has to go into your entertainment center? And I bought like I think 100-foot spool, and I ended up using pretty much all of it. And, I made a couple of the runs too short. So when I bought another spool, I bought 100 feet of it, but I didn't do the back surrounds with it. So I had plenty left over. And now I think I may have gone too far in the other direction where I've got some like coils as slack where I'm like, I've got all this extra wire. What am I going to do with it? So I may cut them down farther. But that's the beauty of having the banana clips, the banana plugs, and a spool of wire. You can just cut, splice, you can make it any length you want. If you make a mistake, you can always make it shorter. You can't make it longer, but you can always make it shorter. And I do have plenty left on the spool, so I'm pretty happy with how that went in my 2 days between COVID.
You did a lot in those 2 days.
Yeah, I did. Like, basically, on the first day, I spent the whole day just crawling around on the floor, removed everything in the entertainment center, just crawling around back there, pulling out all the old wires, putting everything in. It's refreshing. Just, if you can imagine the back of an AV receiver with, six pairs of wire. I mean, I do the math wrong all the time. It was 5.1, right? Well, it's five speakers plus you got the subwoofer. But anyway, each one of those is like this little speaker wire, and it's split, and then like the little stranded, wire that's twisted and shoved into a little hole and screwed down in it. And they're all so close to each other. It's just such a mess to just rip all that out and to have plugs, plug, 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 plug. It's so much nicer. I feel so much better. It's just like an OCD like dream. I should have done this ages ago.
Nice. All right. We all should go to bed for John's sake as well as mine. So let's figure out some titles.
Let's see what we got here.
I do like the Glory speakers quite a lot.
I got right angle banana plugs for some of them, straight banana plugs for others. Yeah. I hope these things hold up.
Let's see.
Super duper positive.
That was at like that.
It's one of my favorite lines from The Simpsons. It's where he's flipping through the channel and lands on the news when the newscaster is in mid-sentence, and the mid-sentence is, has filed for super-duper bankruptcy, which is terrible news for the company's only shareholder, Homer Simpson. Super-duper, because that's what financial news sounds like if you're Homer Simpson. They filed for super-duper bankruptcy.
Let's see.
I like Glory speakers, like Alter for your speaker.
It's got to be the Glory speakers. That's so good.
And I'm not going to argue. I like it.
Let's see what else is in here. There were some other ones that I liked.
I like Brings Back the Boom. That's why I suggested it.
That's pretty good.
Super Duper Positive is also very good. But the Glory
speakers
are
very snotty.
Better.
Yeah, Glory speakers
are well today.
Let's see.
Glory speakers is my winner so far.
Yeah.
Frequencies that you will miss. Human speech frequencies, kind of important.
I kind of like horizontally opposed. That's fun.
So you've got a horizontally opposed sub. It's only a two-cylinder though.
I did look on the Amazon page, and they do use the term force canceling now. I don't know if they did, back when I bought it, but yeah, I'm so ashamed that I spent this much money on a subwoofer.
I mean, it's literally like, if you want a subwoofer that size that's good, that's it. You got
I know.
It. That's the one.
That's why I'm like, and I couldn't believe it when I bought it. I'm like, surely there has to be other decent options.
No,
there weren't.
No. I mean, you could, even if you want like to get close to that size, they're terrible. And they're not as small. It's ridiculous. I don't understand what people don't
know. Oh, John, can you get me a link for your receiver? I don't care if it's Amazon or like a Sony or Denon or whoever it is.
Available for you.
Denon? Is that how you say that brand? I always said Denon in my head.
I always said Denon.
Ew.
I think that now that I've watched all the YouTube things, I think it's Denon based on
Denon
all the other.
Sounds better.
Well, I hate to tell you, that ain't it. As far as we know.
It's like Whack-em.
How about Marantz? That's a fun one. Marantz.
That actually, Marantz, I've looked at Marantz's in the past because they actually make somewhat compact receivers. If you want like a small receiver to fit in a small,
yeah, they do.
Cabinet,
yeah, not like full height. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, they actually make like some of the smallest ones that exist, but they're still. It's still so much bigger than like a Sonos amp. And, yeah, but yeah, Marantz is probably what I would get if I were to get a receiver, just because I would want something that is like smaller, simpler, you know, like these, especially like these new receivers, like the one you just sent here, this Pioneer thing, this is yours.
Yeah.
These are like receivers got bigger. It, like at some point, maybe like 15 years ago, like they used to be the height of like, maybe not DVD players.
I know what you're talking about, but I've never owned one in the smaller era. All of mine have been like pretty much exactly this size. But yeah, they did make a big bump up.
Yeah, they moved to this size. Mostly once we started going to like, you know, 7.1, and you know,
physically speaking, yeah, if you look at the back of them, it's not like there's a lot of wasted space for connectors. It's really jammed in there.
Yeah,
especially since they had to add HDMI to like this, yes, the standard receiver thing. All of a sudden it was like, oh, now you need HDMI and now you need 7 HDMI. Like those things just take up room.
Yeah, exactly. Like they do so much and they have so many ports and jacks and whatever. Like there's so many inputs.
And it kind of amazes, like they didn't change size when they added, like all of them have like, we do AirPlay, we do Bluetooth. We, you know, like they all have all these, none of the features I use, right? But they all have that in there and that takes up like a tiny corner because it's just like one circuit board.
Yeah, it's like, well, yeah, it's like two chips. They get all that with two chips. And then
but they're never getting rid of the phono output and they have a 11 billion, you know, speaker things and multiple subwoofer outputs. And don't forget about zone two. There's always zone two because you got to have repeats for all of those. Or, anyway. I can't find anything better than the Glory speakers. There was some other link that I was going to put in that I mentioned, and now I don't remember. What was it, Casey?
I don't know. You tell me.
I always love all the weird like little custom ports on the back of these things that do, like, you know, like yours has this RS-232 control port.
Oh, that's not custom. That's like a standard in receivers. It's probably a standard from like 1991 or something, but they all have that.
What controls it?
I don't know. Some kind of like, there's probably some like home theater, like RS-232 serial protocol from the 80s that they all support now for rich people setups or something.
Yeah, probably.
I have no idea what you would plug into that.
John, I'm not in the show notes right now. If you wanted to take a look and see what's there.
I'm trying to remember. I think I mentioned, well, someone will tell me on the show when they do. I'll stick it in there.
Mm-hmm. One of these days we'll do parallel editing in the CMS. Today's.
Oh, I don't think that matters. Too that doesn't matter.
Forget it.
Of all the things I want you to do on either the CMS or the sponsor management thing, that is close to last on the list.
Yeah, and those are both super low priorities right now because I am finally on a roll with Overcast.
I wanted to unpack that. I do not want to do that right now because I am tired. And I'm sure John is dead, but I do want to unpack that with you at some point.
Yeah. Short version is I am rewriting the entire model layer, the sync engine, the model layer, and then on top of that, will be the UI. I'm basically rewriting very large parts of the app except the audio engine. That's not being rewritten because that's all, you know, all my voice boost processing and everything. That's all this wonderful low level C code that there's no reason to rewrite it. But the all the model data sync stuff, and then the UI which you build on top of that, that's all being rewritten over the you know, next year or so. And I've been doing so badly all winter long. The way I build things, it's like starting a car in fifth gear. Like, you can do it. It's going to take a while before you get up to any kind of speed. But then once you do, you can go really fast. Like, that's kind of how I am with development. It's like, I only have one gear. It's fifth gear. And so it's like, I have nothing to show for a long time, and it feels like I'm getting nowhere. And as of like this week, I'm finally getting somewhere. I'm finally getting up to speed, and
it's awesome.
And it's like, and I all the work I've done, like with Blackbird and with all, you know, my Swift learnings and skill sets being built up using Swift Async for stuff, and you know, building towards the Swift UI thing on top of all this. Oh my God, I'm flying now. Like I'm finally starting to get real work done. I'm so happy with Blackbird. Oh my God, that was such the right idea to do that for lots of reasons. Like, I learned a lot doing it. My Swift skills are way better. I've done horrible things to the Swift type system that I'm not proud of.
Oh, then you're a Swift developer.
Yeah, like really, like, oh my God, like the things that you do to make generic code to work with optionals. Oh my God, it's bad. It's real bad. Oh, take a look at some of my recent Blackbird commits. Like, Oh, God.
Well, I will have to take a look because I don't remember.
There was a recent change in Swift 5.8 that actually eases one of those pains. And it was a pain that I hadn't personally experienced. But I was like, hey, if you try to do this and it's optional, it's like a super giant pain. And now it just works. So I think they're aware of those and are working on them. I forget what the specific was. It was like, I think Paul Hudson posted his what's new in Swift 5.8. And one of the examples was one of those cases that used to be like, you know, optionals make your life miserable. And now they don't.
Yeah, here, because this is so, because the thing is, like, what an optional is it's just a struct, and it has associated type raft.
Sum or none.
It's like dot sum or dot none, and so when you're dealing with generic code to do optionals, you have to do some really weird things to, like, so I have this, basically, like, generic decoding of optionals from a SQLite database row. And it's weird. Like, some of the stuff I've had to do in Blackbird to deal with optionals is very, very weird. A lot of weird protocol hacks. A lot, like, very strange things, but it does.
Oh, I see what you're doing here. Yeah.
The one in Swift 5.7, not 5.8, it says allows you to call generic functions using a protocol, but it wouldn't allow that if you had optionals. So if you make it, well, you can look at the example in Paul Hudson's thing, but yeah, if it used to be a pain. And they give an example of like making an array of any numeric, and like one's an int, one's a float, one's a, you know, whatever. And then you just try to call a function on them, but the function is generic. It's like, nope, but now it just works. So I feel like they're knocking those things down as they come up.
That's good. Yeah, that's really good.
Marco, this commit has like 40 lines of unit tests. I'm so fucking happy. I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of you. This is so good.
Yeah.
But yeah, Swift type system, what a pain in the ass.
I am coming to really enjoy parts of it. You know, I had to make Blackbird to really get a lot of it. And now I do get it, and I'm able to write really freaking good code that I wasn't able to write before. Now,
yeah, I mean, once macros land, you will be able to delete a lot of this code if you care.
I don't know that necessarily. I don't know. I'll look at it when it comes to see.
You don't necessarily need to. It is mostly just a convenience, but like a lot of the busy work that if you go through Blackbird, you will see a lot of things that look like repeated because they have to be, because it's just the nature of it. But macros can do all that for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I look forward to all of that. Anyway,
goodbye,
let's
people.
Talk for a long time. Let's keep Casey up.
I am tired. I am tired, which means, again, John must be fucking dead. So goodbye, live people.
Bye, live people.
Better. I'm just losing my voice slowly, maybe. But this is my last podcast of the week, so that's good.
All right.